The Postman by David Brin. Prelude. The 13-year thaw. Chill winds still blew. Dusty snow fell. But the ancient sea was in no hurry. The earth had spun 6,000 times since flames blossomed and cities died. Now, after 16 circuits of the sun, plumes of soot no longer roiled from burning forests, turning day into night. 6,000 sunsets had come and gone, gaudy orange, glorious with suspended dust, ever since towering, superheated funnels had punched through to the stratosphere, filling it with tiny bits of suspended rock and soil. The darkened atmosphere passed less sunlight, and it cooled. It hardly mattered anymore what had done it. A giant meteorite, a huge volcano, or a nuclear war. Temperatures and pressures swung out of balance, and great winds blew. All over the north a dingy snow fell, and in places even summer did not erase it. Only the ocean, timeless and obstinate, resistant to change, really mattered. Dark skies had come and gone. The winds pushed ochre growling sunsets. In places the ice grew, and the shallower seas began to sink. But the ocean's vote was all important, and it was not in yet. The earth turned. Men still struggled here and there. And the ocean breathed a sigh of winter. The Cascades. 1. In dust and blood, with the sharp tang of terror stark in his nostrils, a man's mind will sometimes pull forth odd relevancies. After half a lifetime in the wilderness, most of it spent struggling to survive, it still struck Gordon as odd how obscure memories would pop into his mind right in the middle of a life-or-death fight. Panting under a bone-dry thicket, crawling desperately to find a refuge, he suddenly experienced a recollection as clear as the dusty stones under his nose. It was a memory of contrast, of a rainy afternoon in a warm, safe university library long ago, of a lost world filled with books and music and carefree philosophical ramblings, words on a page. Dragging his body through the tough, unyielding bracken, he could almost see the letters, black against white. And although he couldn't recall the obscure author's name, the words came back with utter clarity. Short of death itself, there is no such thing as a total defeat. There is never a disaster so devastating that a determined person cannot pull something out of the ashes by risking all that he or she has left. Nothing in the world is more dangerous than a desperate man. Gordon wished the long-dead writer were here right now, sharing his predicament. He wondered what Pollyanna-ish glow the fellow might find around this catastrophe. Scratched and torn from his desperate escape into this dense thicket, he crawled as quietly as he could, stopping to lay still and squeeze his eyes shut whenever the floating dust seemed about to make him sneeze. It was slow, painful progress, and he wasn't even sure where he was headed. Minutes ago he had been as comfortable and well-stocked as any solitary traveler could hope to be these days. Now Gordon was reduced to not much more than a ripped shirt, faded jeans, and camp moccasins, and the thorns were cutting them all to bits. A tapestry of fiery pain followed each new scratch down his arms and back. But in this awful bone-dry jungle there was nothing to do but crawl onward, and pray his twisting path did not deliver him back to his enemies, to those who had effectively killed him already. Finally, when he had come to think the hellish growth would never end, an opening appeared ahead. A narrow cleft split the brush and overlooked a slope of tumbled rock. Gordon pulled free of the thorns at last, rolled over onto his back, and stared up at the hazy sky, grateful simply for air that wasn't foul with the heat of dry decay. "Welcome to Oregon," he thought bitterly. "And I thought Idaho was bad." He lifted one arm and tried to wipe the dust out of his eyes. Or is it that I'm simply getting too old for this sort of thing? After all, he was over 30 now. beyond the typical life expectancy of a post-Holocaust traveler. Oh, Lord, I wish I was home again. He wasn't thinking of Minneapolis. The prairie today was a hell he had struggled for more than a decade to escape. No, home meant more to Gordon than any particular place. A hamburger, a hot bath, music, methylate, a cool beer. As his labored breathing settled, other sounds came to the fore. The all-too-clear noise of happy looting. It rose from 100 feet or so down the mountainside. Laughter, as the delighted robbers tore through Gordon's gear. A few friendly neighborhood cops, Gordon added, still cataloging the amenities of a world long gone. The bandits had caught him off guard as he sipped elderberry tea by a late afternoon campfire. From that first instant, as they charged up the trail straight at him, it had been clear that the hot-faced men would as soon kill Gordon as look at him. He hadn't waited for them to decide which to do. Throwing scalding tea into the face of the first bearded robber, he dove right into the nearby brambles. 2 gunshots had followed him, and that was all. Probably his carcass wasn't worth as much to the thieves as an irreplaceable bullet. They already had all his goods anyway. Or so they probably think. Gordon's smile was bitterly thin as he sat up carefully, backing along his rocky perch until he felt sure he was out of view of the slope below. He plucked his travel belt free of twigs and drew the half-full canteen for a long, desperately needed drink. Bless you, paranoia, he thought. Not once since the Doom War had he ever allowed the belt more than 3 feet from his side. It was the only thing he had been able to grab before diving into the brambles. The dark gray metal of his .38 revolver shone even under a fine layer of dust as he drew it from his holster. Gordon blew on the snub-nosed weapon and carefully checked its action. Soft clicking testified in understated eloquence to the craftsmanship and deadly precision of another age. Even in killing, the old world had made well. Especially in the art of killing, Gordon reminded himself. Raucous laughter carried up from the slope below. Normally he traveled with only 4 rounds loaded. Now he pulled 2 more precious cartridges from a belt pouch and filled the empty chambers under and behind the hammer. Firearm safety was no longer a major consideration, especially since he expected to die this evening anyway. 16 years chasing a dream, Gordon thought. First that long futile struggle against the collapse, then scratching to survive through the 3-year winter, and finally more than a decade of moving from place to place, dodging pestilence and hunger, fighting goddamned holonists and packs of wild dogs, half a lifetime spent as a wandering Dark Age minstrel, play-acting for meals in order to make it 1 day more while I searched for someplace. Gordon shook his head. He knew his own dreams quite well. They were a fool's fantasies, and had no place in the present world. For some place where someone was taking responsibility. He pushed the thought aside. Whatever he had been looking for, his long seeking seemed to have ended here, in the dry, cold mountains of what had once been eastern Oregon. From the sounds below, he could tell that the bandits were packing up, getting ready to move off with their plunder. Thick patches of desiccated creeper blocked Gordon's view downslope through the ponderosa pines, but soon a burly man in a faded plaid hunting coat appeared from the direction of his campsite, moving northeast on a trail leading down the mountainside. The man's clothing confirmed what Gordon remembered from those blurred seconds of the attack, at least his assailants weren't wearing army surplus camouflage, the trademark of Hone survivalists. They must be just regular, run-of-the-mill, may-they-please-roast-in-hell bandits. If so, then there was a sliver of a chance the plan glimmering in his mind just might accomplish something. Perhaps. The first bandit had Gordon's all-weather jacket tied around his waist. In his right arm he cradled the pump shotgun Gordon had carried all the way from Montana. "Come on!" the bearded robber yelled back up the trail. "That's enough gloating! Get that stuff together and move it!" The leader, Gordon decided. Another man, smaller and more shabby, hurried into view carrying a cloth sack and a battered rifle.
"Boy, what a haul! We ought to celebrate!
When we bring this stuff back, can we have all the shine we want, Jazz? The small robber hopped like an excited bird. Boy, Sheba and the girls will bust when they hear about that little rabbit we drove off into the briar patch. I never seen anything run so fast. He giggled. Gordon frowned at the insult added to injury. It was the same nearly everywhere he had been. A post-Holocaust callousness to which he'd never grown accustomed, even after all this time. With only one eye peering through the scrub grass rimming his cleft, he took a deep breath and shouted, "I wouldn't count on getting drunk yet, Brer Bear!" Adrenaline turned his voice more shrill than he wanted, but that couldn't be helped. The big man dropped awkwardly to the ground, scrambling for cover behind a nearby tree. The skinny robber, though, gawked up at the hillside.
"What? Who's up there?"
Gordon felt a small wash of relief. Their behavior confirmed that the sons of bitches weren't true survivalists, certainly not wholenists. If they had been, he'd probably be dead by now. The other bandits, Gordon counted a total of five, hurried down the trail carrying their booty.
"Get down!" their leader commanded from his hiding place.
Scrawny seemed to wake up to his exposed position and hurried to join his comrades behind the undergrowth. All except one robber, a sallow-faced man with salt-and-pepper sideburns, wearing an alpine hat. Instead of hiding, he moved forward a little, chewing a pine needle and casually eyeing the thicket.
"Why bother?" he asked calmly.
"That poor fella had on barely more than his skibbies when we pounced him. We've got a shotgun. Let's find out what he wants."
Gordon kept his head down, but he couldn't help noticing the man's lazy, affected drawl. He was the only one who was clean-shaven, and even from here Gordon could tell that his clothes were cleaner, more meticulously tended. At a muttered growl from his leader, the casual bandit shrugged and sauntered over behind a forked pine. Barely hidden, he called up the hillside.
"Are you there, Mr. Rabbit? If so, I am so sorry you didn't stay to invite us to tea. Still, aware how Jazz and little Wally tend to treat visitors, I suppose I cannot blame you for cutting out."
Gordon couldn't believe he was trading banter with this twit.
"That's what I figured at the time," he called. "Thanks for understanding my lack of hospitality. By the way, with whom am I speaking?"
The tall fellow smiled broadly.
"With whom? Ah, grammarian. What joy. It's been so long since I've heard an educated voice."
He doffed the alpine hat and bowed.
"I am Roger Everett Septeen, at one time a member of the Pacific Stock Exchange, and presently your robber. As for my colleagues..."
The bushes rustled. Septeen listened and finally shrugged.
"Alas," he called to Gordon. "Normally I'd be tempted by a chance for some real conversation. I'm sure you're as starved for it as I. Unfortunately, the leader of our small brotherhood of cutthroats insists that I find out what you want and get this over with. So speak your piece, Mr. Rabbit. We are all ears."
Gordon shook his head. The fellow obviously classed himself a wit, but his humor was fourth-rate, even by post-war standards.
"I notice you fellows aren't carrying all of my gear. You wouldn't by chance have decided to take only what you needed and left enough for me to survive, would you?"
From the scrub below came a high giggle, then more hoarse chuckles as others joined in. Roger Septeen looked left and right and lifted his hands. His exaggerated sigh seemed to say that he at least appreciated the irony in Gordon's question.
"Alas," he repeated, "I recall mentioning that possibility to my compatriots. For instance, our women might find some use for your aluminum tent poles and pack frame, but I suggested we leave the nylon bag and tent, which are useless to us. In a sense, we have done this. However, I don't think that Wally's, alterations will meet your approval."
Again, that shrieking giggle rose from the bushes. Gordon sagged a little.
"What about my boots? You all seem well enough shod. Do they fit any of you anyway? Could you leave them? And my jacket and gloves?"
Septeen coughed.
Ah, yes. They're the main items, aren't they? Other than the shotgun, of course, which is non-negotiable. Gordon spat. Of course, idiot. Only a blowhard states the obvious.
Again, the voice of the bandit leader could be heard, muffled by the foliage. Again, there were giggles. With a pained expression, the ex-stockbroker sighed.
My leader asks what you offer in trade. Of course, I know you have nothing. Still, I must inquire.
As a matter of fact, Gordon had a few things they might want. His belt compass, for instance, and a Swiss Army knife. But what were his chances of arranging an exchange and getting out alive? It didn't take telepathy to tell that these bastards were only toying with their victim. A fuming anger filled him, especially over Septine's false show of compassion. He had witnessed this combination of cruel contempt and civilized manners in other once-educated people over the years since the collapse. By his lights, people like this were far more contemptible than those who had simply succumbed to the barbaric times.
"Look," he shouted, "you don't need those damn boots. You've no real need for my jacket or my toothbrush or my notebook either. This area's clean, so what do you need my Geiger counter for? I'm not stupid enough to think I can have my shotgun back. But without some of those other things, I'll die, damn you."
The echo of his curse seemed to pour down the long slope of the mountainside, leaving a hanging silence in its wake. Then the bushes rustled, and the big bandit leader stood up. Spitting contemptuously upslope, he snapped his fingers at the others.
"Now I know he's got no gun," he told them.
His thick eyebrows narrowed, and he gestured in Gordon's general direction.
"Run away, little rabbit! Run, or we'll skin you and have you for supper!"
He hefted Gordon's shotgun, turned his back, and sauntered casually down the trail. The others fell in behind, laughing. Roger Septime gave the mountainside an ironic shrug and a smile, then gathered up his share of the loot and followed his compatriots. They disappeared around a bend in the narrow forest path, but for minutes afterward Gordon heard the softly diminishing sound of someone happily whistling. You imbecile. Weak as his chances had been, he had spoiled them completely by appealing to reason and charity. In an era of tooth and claw, nobody ever did that except out of impotence. The bandit's uncertainty had evaporated just as soon as he foolishly asked for fair play. Of course, he could have fired his .38, wasting a precious bullet to prove he wasn't completely harmless. That would have forced them to take him seriously again. Then why didn't I do that? Was I too afraid? Probably, he admitted. I'll very likely die of exposure tonight, but that's still hours away. Far enough to remain only an abstract threat, less frightening and immediate than five ruthless men with guns. He punched his left palm with his fist.
Oh, stuff it, Gordon. You can psychoanalyze yourself this evening while you're freezing to death.
What it all comes down to, though, is that you are one prize fool, and this is probably the end. He got up stiffly and began edging cautiously down the slope. Although he wasn't quite ready to admit it yet, Gordon felt a growing certainty that there could only be one solution, only one even faintly possible way out of this disaster. As soon as he was free of the thicket, Gordon limped to the trickling stream to wash his face and the worst of his cuts. He wiped sweat-soaked strands of brown hair out of his eyes. His scrapes hurt like hell, but none of them looked bad enough to persuade him to use the thin tube of the precious iodine in his belt pouch. He refilled his canteen and thought. Besides his pistol and half-shredded clothes, a pocket knife and compass, his pouch held a miniature fishing kit that might prove useful if he ever made it over the mountains to a decent watershed, and, of course, 10 spare rounds for his .38. Small, blessed relics of industrial civilization. Back at the beginning, during the riots and the Great Starvation, it had seemed that the one thing in inexhaustible supply was ammunition. If only turn-of-the-century America had stockpiled and distributed food half so well as its citizens had cached mountains of bullets. Rough Stones jabbed his throbbing left foot as Gordon gingerly hurried toward his former campsite. Clearly these half-shredded moccasins would get him nowhere. His torn clothes would be about as effective against freezing mountain autumn nights as his pleas had been against the bandits' hard hearts. The small clearing where he had made camp only an hour or so ago was deserted now, but his worst fears were surpassed by the havoc he found there. His tent had been converted into a pile of nylon shreds, his sleeping bag a small blizzard of scattered goose down. All Gordon found intact was the slim longbow he had been carving from a cut sapling, and a line of experimental venison-gut strings. Probably thought it was a walking stick. 16 years after the last factory had burned, Gordon's robbers had completely overlooked the potential value of the bow and strings when the ammo finally ran out. He used the bow to poke through the wreckage, looking for anything else to salvage. I can't believe it. They took my journal. That prig Septine probably looks forward to poring over it during the snowtime, chuckling over my adventures and my naivete while my bones are being picked clean by cougars and buzzards. Of course, the food was all gone. The jerky, the bag of split grains that a small Idaho village had let him have in exchange for a few songs and stories, the tiny hoard of rock candy he had found in the mechanical bowels of a looted vending machine. It's just as well about the candy, Gordon thought as he plucked his trampled, ruined toothbrush out of the dust. Now why the hell did they have to do that? Late in the 3-year winter, while the remnants of his militia platoon still struggled to guard the soy silos of Wayne, Minnesota, for a government nobody had heard from in months, 5 of his comrades had died of raging oral infections. They were awful, inglorious deaths, and no one had ever been sure if one of the war bugs was responsible, or the cold and hunger and near-total lack of modern hygiene. All Gordon knew was that the specter of his teeth rotting in his head was his own personal phobia. Bastards, he thought, as he flung the little brush aside. He kicked the rubbish one last time. There was nothing here to change his mind. You're procrastinating. Go, do it! Gordon started off a little stiffly, but soon he was moving down trail as quickly and silently as he could, making time through the bone-dry forest. The burly outlaw leader had promised to eat him if they met again. Cannibalism had been common in the early days, and these mountain men might have acquired a taste for the long pork. Still, he had to persuade them that a man with nothing to lose must be reckoned with. Within half a mile or so, their tracks were familiar to him. 2 traces with the soft outlines of deer hide, and 3 with pre-war Vibram soles. They were moving at a leisurely pace, and it would be no trouble simply to catch up with his enemies. That was not his plan, however. Gordon tried to remember this morning's climb up this same trail. The path drops in altitude as it winds north along the east face of the mountain before switching back south and east into the desert valley below. But what if I were to cut above the main trail and traverse the slope higher up? I might be able to come down on them while it's still light, while they're still gloating and expecting nothing. If the shortcut is there. The trail wove gradually downhill toward the northeast, in the direction of the lengthening shadows, toward the deserts of eastern Oregon and Idaho. Gordon must have passed below the robbers' sentinels yesterday or this morning, and they had taken their time following him until he was settled into camp. Their lair had to be somewhere off this same trail. Even limping, Gordon was able to move silently and quickly, the only advantage of camp moccasins over boots. Soon he heard faint sounds below and ahead. The raiding party. The men were laughing, joking together. It was painful to hear. It wasn't so much that they were laughing over him. Callous cruelty was a part of life today, and if Gordon couldn't reconcile himself to it, he at least recognized he was the 20th century oddball in today's savage world. But the sounds reminded him of other laughter, the rough jokes of men who shared danger together. Drew Sims, freckle-faced pre-med with a floppy grin and a deadly skill at chess or poker. The Holnists got him when they overran Wayne and burned the silos. Tiny Kilry, saved my life twice, and all he wanted when he was on his deathbed, the war mumps tearing him apart, was for me to read him stories. Then there had been Lieutenant Van, their half-Vietnamese platoon leader. Gordon had never known until it was too late that the lieutenant was cutting his own rations and giving them to his men. He asked at the end to be buried in an American flag. Gordon had been alone for so long. He missed the company of such men almost as much as the friendship of women. Watching the brush on his left, he came to an opening that seemed to promise a sloping track, a shortcut perhaps, to the north across the mountain face. The rust-dry scrub crackled as he left the path and broke his own trail. Gordon thought he remembered the perfect site for a bushwhack, a switchback that passed under a high stony horseshoe. A sniper might find a place a little way above that rocky outcrop, within point-blank range of anyone hiking along the hairpin. If I can just get there first. He might pin them down by surprise and force them to negotiate. That was the advantage in being the one with nothing to lose. Any sane bandit would prefer to live and rob another day. He had to believe they would part with boots, a jacket, and some food, against the risk of losing one or two of their band. Gordon hoped he would not have to kill anybody. Oh, grow up, please! His worst enemy over the next few hours could be his archaic scruples. Just this once be ruthless. The voices on the trail faded as he cut across the slope of the mountain. Several times he had to detour around jagged gullies or scabrous patches of ugly bramble. Gordon concentrated on finding the quickest way toward his rocky ambuscade. Have I gone far enough? Grimly he kept on. According to imperfect memory, the switchback he had in mind came only after a long sweep northward along the east face of the mountain. A narrow animal track let him hurry through the pine thickets, pausing frequently to check his compass. He faced a quandary. To stand a chance of catching his adversaries, he had to stay above them. Yet if he kept too high, he might go right past his target without knowing it. And twilight was not long away. A flock of wild turkeys scattered as he jogged into a small clearing. Of course, the thinned human population probably had something to do with the return of wildlife, but it was also one more sign that he had come into better-watered country than the arid lands of Idaho. His bow might someday prove useful, should he live long enough to learn to use it. He angled downslope, beginning to get worried. Surely by now the main trail was quite a bit below him, if it hadn't already switched back a few times. It was possible he had already gone too far north. At last Gordon realized the game path was turning inexorably westward. It appeared to be rising again as well, toward what looked like another gap in the mountains, shrouded in late afternoon mist. He stopped a moment to catch his breath and his bearings. Perhaps this was yet another pass through the cold, semi-arid Cascade Range, leading eventually into the Willamette River Valley and thence the Pacific Ocean. His map was gone, but he knew that at most a couple weeks' walk in that direction ought to bring him to water, shelter, fishing streams, game to hunt, and maybe... and maybe some people trying to put something right in the world again. The sunlight through the high fringe of clouds was like a luminous halo, akin to the dimly remembered sky glow of city lights, a promise that had led him ever inward from the Midwest, searching. The dream, hopeless as he knew it was, simply would not go away. Gordon shook his head. For certain there would be snow in that range, and cougars, and starvation. There could be no turning away from his plan, not if he wanted to live. He tried hard to cut down slope, but the narrow game paths kept forcing him north and westward. The switchback had to be behind him by now, but the thick, dry undergrowth diverted him farther into the new pass. In his frustration, Gordon almost missed the sound, but then he stopped suddenly, listening. Were those voices? A steep ravine opened up the forest just ahead. He hurried toward it until he could see the outlines of this mountain and others in the chain, wrapped in a thick haze, amber high on their westward flanks, and a darkening purple where the sun no longer shone. The sounds seemed to be coming from below, to the east, and yes, they were voices. Gordon searched and made out the snake-like line of a trail on the mountain's flank. Far off he caught a brief flash of color moving slowly upward through the woods. The bandits. But why were they moving uphill again? They couldn't be unless... unless Gordon was already far north of the trail he had taken the day before. He must have missed the ambush site altogether and come out above a side path.
The bandits were climbing a fork he had failed to notice yesterday, one leading up into this pass rather than the one he had been caught in. This must be the way to their base. Gordon looked up the mountain. Yes. He could see how a small hollow could fit over to the west, on a shoulder near the lesser-used pass. It would be defensible and very hard to discover by chance. Gordon smiled grimly and turned west as well. The ambush was a lost opportunity, but if he hurried, he could beat the bandits home, perhaps get a few minutes to steal what he needed, food, clothes, something to carry them in. And if the hideout wasn't deserted, well, maybe he could take their women hostage and try to cut a deal. Yeah, that's lots better. Like holding a ticking bomb beats jogging with nitroglycerin. Frankly, he hated all of his alternatives. He started to run, ducking under branches and dodging withered stumps as he charged along the narrow game path. Soon Gordon felt a strange exuberance. He was committed, and none of his typical self-doubt would get in the way now. Battle adrenaline nearly made him high as his stride opened and small shrubs swept by in a blur. He stretched to leap over a toppled, decayed tree trunk, cleared it easily. Landing sent sharp pain lancing up his left leg as something stabbed him through the flimsy moccasins. He sprawled, face first, into the gravel of a dry stream bed. Gordon rolled over, clutching his injury. Through wet, pain-diffracted eyes, he saw that he had tripped over a thick strand of looped, rusted steel cable, no doubt left over from some ancient pre-war logging operation. Again, while his leg throbbed agonizingly, his surface thoughts were absurdly rational. 18 years since my last tetanus shot. Lovely. But no, it hadn't cut him, only tripped him. That was bad enough, though. He held on to his thigh and clamped his mouth shut, trying to ride out a savage cramp. At last the tremors subsided, and he dragged himself over to the toppled tree, gingerly hoisting himself into sitting position. He hissed through clenched teeth as the waves of agony slowly faded. Meanwhile, he could hear the bandit party passing not far below, taking away the head start that had been his only advantage. So much for all those great plans to beat them to their hideout. He listened until their voices faded up the trail. At last, Gordon used his bow as a staff and tried standing up. Letting weight settle slowly on his left leg, he found it would support him, though it still quivered tenderly. 10 years ago, I could have taken a fall like that and been up and running without another thought. Face it, you're obsolete, Gordon. Worn out. These days, 34 and alone is the same as being ready to die. There would be no ambush now. He couldn't even chase the bandits, not all the way up to that notch in the mountain. It would be useless to try to track them on a moonless night. He took a few steps as the throbbing slowly subsided. Soon he was able to walk without leaning too hard on his makeshift staff. Fine, but where to? Perhaps he should spend the remaining daylight looking for a cave, a pile of pine needles, anything to give him a chance to live through the night. In the growing chill, Gordon watched shadows climb higher above the desert valley floor, merging and darkening the flanks of the nearby mountains. The reddening sun probed through chinks in the range of snowy peaks to his left. He was facing north, unable quite yet to summon the energy to move, when his eye was caught by a sudden flash of light, a sharp glinting against the rolling forest green on the opposite flank of this narrow pass. Still favoring his tender foot, Gordon took a few steps forward, his brow furrowed. The forest fires that had seared so much of the dry Cascades had spared the thick forests on that part of the mountainside. And yes, something across the way was catching the sunlight like a mirror. From the folds in the hillsides, he guessed that the reflection could only be seen from this very spot, and only in the late afternoon. So he had guessed wrong. The bandit's roost wasn't in that hollow higher up in the pass to the west after all, but much closer. Only a stroke of luck had given it away. "So you're giving me clues now?" "Now?" he accused the world. "I don't have enough troubles as it is without being offered straws to grasp at." Hope was an addiction. It had driven him westward for half his life. Moments after all but giving up,
Gordon found himself piecing together the outlines of a new plan. Could he try to rob a cabin filled with armed men? He pictured himself kicking in the door to their wide-eyed astonishment, holding them all at bay with a pistol in one hand, while he tied them all up with the other. Why not? They might be drunk, and he was desperate enough to try. Could he take hostages? Hell, even a milk goat would be more valuable to them than his boots. A captured woman should bring more in trade than that. The idea was a sour taste in his mouth. It depended on the bandit leader behaving rationally, for one thing. Would the bastard recognize the secret power of a desperate man and let him go with what he needed? Gordon had seen pride make men do stupid things, more often than not. If it comes down to a chase, I'm cooked. I couldn't outrun a badger right now. He eyed the reflection across the pass and decided he had very little choice after all. It was slow going from the first. His legs still ached, and he had to stop every 100 feet or so to scan merging and crisscrossing trails for his enemy's spoor. He also found he was checking shadows as potential ambushes and made himself quit. These men weren't Holmists. Indeed, they seemed lazy. Gordon guessed that their pickets would be close to home, if they maintained any at all. As the light faded, the footprints were lost in the gravelly soil, but Gordon knew where he was going. The glinting reflection could no longer be seen, but the ravine on the opposite shoulder of the mountain saddle was a dark, tree-lined V-silhouette. He chose a likely path and hurried ahead. It was growing dark quickly. A stiff, cold breeze blew damply off the misty heights. Gordon limped up a dry stream bed and leaned on his staff as he climbed a set of switchbacks. Then, when he guessed he was within a quarter mile of his goal, the path suddenly failed. He kept his forearms up to protect his face while he tried to move quietly through the dry undergrowth. He fought down a lingering, threatening urge to sneeze in the floating dust. Chilly night fog was flowing down the mountainsides. Soon the ground would shimmer with faintly luminous ground frost. Still, Gordon shivered less from the cold than from nerves. He knew he was getting close. One way or another, he was about to have an encounter with death. In his youth, he had read about heroes, historical and fictional. Nearly all of them, when the time came for action, seemed to be able to push aside their personal burdens of worry, confusion, angst, for at least the time when action impended. But Gordon's mind didn't seem to work that way. Instead, it just filled with more and more complexities, a turmoil of regrets. It wasn't that he had doubts about what had to be done. By every standard he lived by, this was the right thing to do. Survival demanded it. And anyway, if he was to be a dead man, at least he could make the mountains a little safer for the next wayfarer by taking a few of the bastards with him. Still, the nearer he drew to the confrontation, the more he realized that he hadn't wanted his dharma to come to this. He did not really wish to kill any of these men. It had been this way, even as with Lieutenant Van's little platoon, he had struggled to help maintain a peace and a fragment of a nation that had already died. And afterward he had chosen the life of a minstrel, a traveling actor and laborer, partly in order to keep moving, searching for a light somewhere. A few of the surviving post-war communities were known to accept outsiders as new members. Women were always welcome, of course, but some accepted new men. And yet there was so often a catch. A new male frequently had to duel, kill for the right to sit at a communal table, or bring back a scalp from a feuding clan to prove his prowess. There were few real Holmists anymore in the plains and Rockies, but many survivor outposts he had encountered nevertheless demanded rituals of which Gordon wanted no part. And now here he was, counting bullets, a part of him coldly noting that if he made them count, there were probably enough for all the bandits. Another sparse berry thicket blocked his path. What the patch lacked in fruit, it made up for in thorns. This time Gordon moved along its edge, carefully picking his way in the gathering gloom. His sense of direction, honed after 13 years of wandering, was automatic. He moved silently, cautious, without rising above the maelstrom of his own thoughts. All considered, it was amazing a man like him had lived this long. Everyone he had known or admired as a boy had died, along with all the hopes any of them had had. The soft world, made for dreamers like himself, broke apart when he was only 18. Long since then, he'd come to realize that his persistent optimism had to be a form of hysterical insanity. Hell, everybody's crazy these days. Yes, he answered himself. But paranoia and depression are adaptive now. Idealism is only stupid. Gordon paused at a small blob of color. He peered into the bramble and saw, about a yard inside, a solitary clump of blueberries, apparently overlooked by the local black bear. The mist heightened Gordon's sense of smell, and he could pick their faint autumn mustiness out of the air. Ignoring the stabbing thorns, he reached in and drew back a sticky handful. The tart sweetness was a wild thing in his mouth, like life. Twilight was almost gone, and a few wan stars winked through a darkling overcast. The cold breeze rifled his torn shirt and reminded Gordon that it was time to get this business over with before his hands were too chilled to pull a trigger. He wiped the stickiness on his pants as he rounded the end of the thicket. And there suddenly, 100 feet or so away, it seemed, a broad pane of glass glinted at him in the dim sky glow. Gordon ducked back behind the thorns. He drew his revolver and held his right wrist with his left hand until his breathing settled. Then he checked the pistol's action. It clicked quietly, in an almost gentle, mechanical complacency. The spare ammo was heavy in his breast pocket. A hazard to quick or forceful motion, the thicket yielded as he settled back against it, heedless of a few more scratches. Gordon closed his eyes and meditated for calm. And, yes, for forgiveness. In the chilly darkness, the only accompaniment to his breathing was the rhythmic ratchet of the crickets. A swirl of cold fog blew around him. No, he sighed. There's no other way. He raised his weapon and swung around. The structure looked distinctly odd. For one thing, the distant patch of glass was dark. That was queer. But stranger still was the silence. He'd have thought the bandits would have a fire going, and that they would be loudly celebrating. It was nearly too dark to see his own hand. The trees loomed like hulking trolls on every side. Dimly, the glass pane seemed to stand out against some black structure, reflecting silvery highlights of a rolling cloud cover. Thin wisps of haze drifted between Gordon and his objective, confusing the image, making it shimmer. He walked forward slowly, giving most of his attention to the ground. Now was not the time to step on a dry twig, or to be stabbed by a sharp stone as he shuffled in the dimness. He glanced up, and once more the eerie feeling struck him. There was something wrong about the edifice ahead, made out mostly in silhouette behind the faintly glimmering glass. It didn't look right somehow. Box-like, its upper section seemed to be mostly window. Below, it struck him as more like painted metal than wood. At the corners, the fog grew thicker. Gordon could tell his perspective was wrong. He had been looking for a house or large cottage. As he neared, he realized the thing was actually much closer than he'd thought. The shape was familiar, as if... His foot came down on a twig. The snap filled his ears, and he crouched, peering into the gloom with a desperate need that transcended sight. It felt as if a frantic power drove out of his eyes, propelled by his terror, demanding the mist be cloven so he could see. Obediently, it seemed, the dry fog suddenly fell open before him. Pupils dilated. Gordon saw that he was less than 2 meters from the window. His own face reflected, wide-eyed and wild-haired, and saw, superimposed on his own image, a vacant, skeletal death mask. A hooded skull grinning in welcome. Gordon crouched, hypnotized, as a superstitious thrill coursed up his spine. He was unable to bring his weapon to bear, unable to cause his larynx to make sound. The haze swirled as he listened for proof that he had really gone mad, wishing with all his might that the death's head was an illusion. Alas, poor Gordon. The sepulchral image overlay his reflection and seemed to shimmer a greeting.
Never in all these awful years had Death, owner of the world, manifested to him as a specter. Gordon's numbed mind could think of nothing but to attend the Elsinorian figure's bidding. He waited, unable to take his gaze away or even to move. The skull and his face and the skull. The thing had captured him without a fight, and now seemed content to grin about it. At last it was something as mundane as a monkey reflex that came to Gordon's aid. No matter how mesmerizing, how terrifying, no unchanging sight can keep a man riveted forever. Not when it seemed that nothing at all was happening, nothing changing. Where courage and education failed him, where his nervous system had let him down, boredom finally took command. His breath exhaled. He heard it whistle between his teeth. Without willing them to, Gordon felt his eyes turn slightly from the visage of Death. A part of him noted that the window was set in a door. The handle lay before him. To the left, another window. To the right was the hood. The hood. The hood of a jeep. The hood of an abandoned, rusted jeep that lay in a faint rut in the forest gully. He blinked at the hood of the abandoned, rusted jeep with ancient U.S. government markings and the skeleton of a poor dead civil servant within, skull pressed against the passenger side window, facing Gordon. The strangled sigh he let out felt almost ectoplasmic. The relief and embarrassment were so palpable. Gordon straightened up, and it felt like unwinding from a fetal position, like being born. Oh. Oh, Lordy, he said, just to hear his own voice. Moving his arms and legs, he paced a long circle around the vehicle, obsessively glancing at its dead occupant, coming to terms with its reality. He breathed deeply as his pulse settled and the roar in his ears gradually ebbed. Finally, he sat down on the forest floor with his back against the cool door on the jeep's left side. Trembling, he used both hands as he put the revolver back on safety and slid it into its holster. Then he pulled out his canteen and drank in slow, full swallows. Gordon wished he had something stronger, but water right now tasted as sweet as life. Night was full. The cold, bone-chilling. Still, Gordon spent a few moments putting off the obvious. He would never find the bandit's roost now, having followed a false clue so far into a pitch-dark wilderness. The jeep at least offered some form of shelter, better than anything else around. He hauled himself up and placed his hand on the door lever, calling up motions that had once been second nature to 200 million of his countrymen, and which, after a stubborn moment, forced the latch to give. The door let out a loud screech as he pulled hard and forced it open. He slid onto the cracked vinyl of the seat and inspected the interior. The jeep was one of those reversed, driver-on-the-right types the post office had used back in the once-upon-a-time before the Doom War. The dead mailman, what was left of him, was slumped over on the far side. Gordon avoided looking at the skeleton for a moment. The storage area of the truck was nearly full with canvas sacks. The smell of old paper filled the small cabin at least as much as the faded odor of the mummified remains. With a hopeful oath, Gordon snatched up a metal flask from the shift well. It sloshed. To have held liquid for 16 years or more, it had to be well sealed. Gordon swore as he twisted and pried at the cap. He pounded it against the doorframe, then attacked it again. Frustration made his eyes tear, but at last he felt the cap give. Soon he was rewarded with a slow, rough turning, and then the heady, distantly familiar aroma of whiskey. Maybe I've been a good boy after all. Maybe there is indeed a God. He took a mouthful and coughed as the warming fire streamed down. Two more small swallows and he fell back against the seat, breathing almost a sigh. He wasn't ready yet to face removing the jacket draped over the skeleton's narrow shoulders. Gordon grabbed sacks, bearing the imprint U.S. Postal Service, and piled them about himself. Leaving a narrow opening in the door to let in fresh mountain air, he burrowed under the makeshift blankets with his bottle. At last he looked over at his host, contemplating the dead civil servant's American flag shoulder patch. He unscrewed the flask, and this time raised the container toward the hooded garment.
"Believe it or not, Mr. Postman, I always thought you folks gave good and honest service. Oh, people used you as whipping boys a lot, but I know what a tough job you all had. I was proud of you, even before the war.
But this, Mr. Mailman," he lifted the flask, "this goes beyond anything I've come to expect. I consider my taxes very well spent."
He drank to the postman, coughing a little but relishing the warm glow.
He settled deeper into the mail sacks and looked at the leather jacket, ribs serrating its sides, arms hanging loosely at odd angles.
Lying still, Gordon felt a sad poignancy, something like homesickness. The jeep, the symbolic faithful letter carrier, the flag patch. They recalled comfort, innocence, cooperation, an easy life that allowed millions of men and women to relax, to smile or argue as they chose, to be tolerant with one another, and to hope to be better people with the passage of time. Gordon had been ready today to kill and to be killed. Now he was glad that it had been averted. They had called him Mr. Rabbit and left him to die. But it was his privilege, without their ever knowing it, to call the bandits countrymen and let them have their lives.
Gordon allowed sleep to come and welcomed back optimism, foolish anachronism that it might be. He lay in a blanket of his own honor and spent the rest of the night dreaming of parallel worlds.
2. Snow and soot covered the ancient tree's broken branches and seared bark. It wasn't dead, not quite yet. Here and there tiny shoots of green struggled to emerge, but they weren't doing well. The end was near. A shadow loomed, and a creature settled onto the drifts, an old wounded thing of the skies, as near death as the tree. Pinions drooping, it laboriously began building a nest, a place of dying. Stick by stick it pecked among the ruined wood on the ground, piling the bits higher until it was clear that it was not a nest at all. It was a pyre. The bloody dying thing settled in atop the kindling and crooned soft music unlike anything ever heard before. A glow began to build, surrounding the beast soon in a rich purple ambience. Blue flames burst forth, and the tree seemed to respond. Aged, ruined branches curled forward toward the heat, like an old man warming his hands. Snow shivered and fell. The green patches grew and began to fill the air with a fragrance of renewal. It was not the creature in the pyre that was reborn, and even in sleep that surprised Gordon. The great bird was consumed, leaving only bones. But the tree blossomed, and from its flowering branches things uncurled and drifted off into the air. He stared in wonderment when he saw that they were balloons, airplanes, and rocket ships. Dreams. They floated away in all directions, and the air was filled with hope.
3. A camp robber bird, looking for blue jays to chase, landed on the jeep's hood with a hollow thump. It squawked, once for territoriality and once for pleasure, then began poking through the thick detritus with its beak. Gordon awakened to the tap-tapping sound. He looked up, bleary-eyed, and saw the gray-flanked bird through the dust-smeared window. It took him moments to remember where he was. The glass windshield, the steering wheel, the smell of metal and paper, all felt like a continuation of one of the night's most vivid dreams, a vision of the old days before the war. He sat dazedly for a few moments, sifting through feelings while the sleep images unraveled and drifted away, out of grasp. Gordon rubbed his eyes, and presently began to consider his situation. If he hadn't left an elephant's trail on his way into this hollow last night, he should be perfectly safe right now. The fact that the whiskey had lain here untouched for 16 years obviously meant the bandits were lazy hunters. They had their traditional stalks and blinds, and had never bothered fully to explore their own mountain. Gordon felt a bit thick-headed. The war had begun when he was 18, a college sophomore, and since then there had been little chance to build a tolerance to 80-proof liquor. Added to yesterday's series of traumas and adrenaline rushes, the whiskey had left him cotton-mouthed and scratchy behind the eyelids. He regretted his lost comforts as much as ever. There would be no tea this morning, nor a damp washcloth or venison jerky for breakfast. No toothbrush. Still, Gordon tried to be philosophical. After all, he was alive. He had a feeling there would be times when each of the items stolen from him would be missed most of all. With any luck, the Geiger counter wouldn't fall into that category. Radiation had been one of his main reasons for going ever westward since leaving the Dakotas. He had grown tired of walking everywhere a slave to his precious counter, always afraid it would be stolen or would break down. Rumor had it that the West Coast had been spared the worst of the fallout, suffering more instead from plagues windborne from Asia. That had been the way with that strange war. Inconsistent, chaotic. It had stopped far short of the spasm everyone had predicted. Instead, it was more like a shotgun blast of one mid-scale catastrophe after another. By itself, any one of the disasters might have been survivable. The initial techno-war at sea and in space might not have been so terrible had it remained contained and not spilled over onto the continents. The diseases weren't as bad in the Eastern Hemisphere, where the enemy's weapons went out of control in his own populace. They probably wouldn't have killed so many in America had the fallout zones not pushed crowds of refugees together and ruined the delicate network of medical services. And the starvation might not have been so awful had terrified communities not blocked rails and roads to keep out the germs. As for the long-dreaded atom, only a tiny fraction of the world's nuclear arsenals were used before the Slavic resurgence collapsed from within and unexpected victory was declared. Those few score bombs were enough to trigger the 3-year winter, but not a century-long night that might have sent man the way of the dinosaurs. For weeks it appeared that a great miracle of restraint had saved the planet. So it seemed. And indeed, even the combination, a few bombs, some bugs, and 3 poor harvests, would not have been enough to ruin a great nation and with it a world. But there was another illness. A cancer from within. Damn you forever, Nathan Holme, Gordon thought. Across a dark continent it was a common litany. He pushed aside the mail sacks. Ignoring the morning chill, he opened his left belt pouch and pulled out a small package wrapped in aluminum foil, coated with melted wax. If there ever had been an emergency, this was one. Gordon would need energy to get through the day. A dozen cubes of beef bouillon were all he had, but they would have to do. Washing down a bitter, salty chunk with a swig from his canteen, Gordon kicked open the left door of the jeep, letting several sacks tumble out onto the frosted ground. He turned to his right and looked at the muffled skeleton that had quietly shared the night with him. "Mr. Postman, I'm going to give you as close to a decent burial as I can manage with my bare hands. I know that's not much payment for what you've given me, but it's all I can offer." He reached over the narrow, bony shoulder and unlocked the driver's door. His moccasins slipped on the icy ground as he got out and stepped carefully around to the other side of the jeep. At least it didn't snow last night. It's so dry up here that the ground ought to thaw enough for digging in a little while. The rusty right-hand door groaned as he pulled. It was tricky, catching the skeleton in an emptied mail sack as it pitched forward. Gordon somehow managed to get the bundle of clothes and bones laid out on the forest floor. He was amazed at the state of preservation. The dry climate had almost mummified the postman's remains, giving insects time to clean up without much mess. The rest of the jeep appeared to have been free from mold for all these years. First, he checked the mailman's apparel. Funny. Why was he wearing a paisley shirt under his jacket? The garment, once colorful but now faded and stained, was a total loss, but the leather jacket was a wonderful find. If big enough, it would improve his chances immeasurably. The footgear looked old and cracked, but perhaps serviceable.
Carefully, Gordon shook out the gruesome dry remnants and laid the shoes against his feet. Maybe a bit large, but then anything would be better than ripped camp moccasins. Gordon slid the bones out onto the mail sack with as little violence as he could manage, surprised at how easy it was. Any superstition had been burned out the night before. All that remained was a mild reverence and an ironic gratitude to the former owner of these things. He shook the clothes, holding his breath against the dust, and hung them on a ponderosa branch to air out. He returned to the jeep. Aha, he thought then. The mystery of the shirt is solved. Right next to where he had slept was a long-sleeved blue uniform blouse with postal service patches on the shoulders. It looked almost new in spite of the years. One for comfort, and another for the boss. Gordon had known postmen to do that when he was a boy. One fellow, during the muggy afternoons of summer, had worn bright Hawaiian shirts as he delivered the mail. The postman had always been grateful for a cool glass of lemonade. Gordon wished he could remember his name. Shivering in the morning chill, he slipped into the uniform shirt. It was only a little bit large. "Maybe I'll grow to fill it out," he mumbled, joking weakly with himself. At 34, he probably weighed less than he had at 17. The glove compartment contained a brittle map of Oregon to replace the one he had lost. Then, with a shout, Gordon grabbed a small square of clear plastic. A scintillator. Far better than his Geiger counter, the little crystal would give off tiny flashes whenever its crystalline interior was struck by gamma radiation. It didn't even need power. Gordon cupped it in front of his eye and watched a few sparse flickerings caused by cosmic rays. Otherwise, the cube was quiescent. Now, what was a pre-war mailman doing with a gadget like that? Gordon wondered idly, as the device went into his pants pocket. The glove compartment flashlight was a loss, of course. The emergency flares were crumbled paste. The bag, of course. On the floor below the driver's seat was a large leather letter carrier sack. It was dry and cracked, but the straps held when he tugged, and the flaps would keep out water. It wouldn't come close to replacing his lost Kelty, but the bag would be a vast improvement over nothing at all. He opened the main compartment, and bundles of aged correspondence spilled out, breaking into scattered piles as brittle rubber bands snapped apart. Gordon picked up a few of the nearest pieces. "From the mayor of Bend, Oregon, to the chairman of the School of Medicine, University of Oregon, Eugene," Gordon intoned the address as though he were playing Polonius. He flipped through more letters. The addresses sounded pompous and archaic. "Dr. Franklin Davis, of the small town of Gilchrist, sends, with the word urgent printed clearly on the envelope, a rather bulky letter to the Director of Regional Disbursement of Medical Supplies, no doubt pleading priority for his requisitions." Gordon's sardonic smile faded into a frown as he turned over one letter after another. Something was wrong here. He had expected to be amused by junk mail and personal correspondence, but there didn't seem to be a single advertisement in the bag. And while there were many private letters, most of the envelopes appeared to be on one or another type of official stationery. Well, there wasn't time for voyeurism anyway. He'd take a dozen or so letters for entertainment and use the backsides for his new journal. He avoided thinking about the loss of the old volume. 16 years' tiny scratchings, now doubtless being perused by that one-time stockbroker robber. It would be read and preserved, he was sure, along with the tiny volumes of verse he had carried in his pack, or he had misread Roger Septine's personality. Someday he would come and get them back. What was a U.S. Postal Service jeep doing out here anyway? And what had killed the postman? He found part of his answer around the back of the vehicle. Bullet holes in the tailgate window, well-grouped midway up the right side. Gordon looked over to the Ponderosa. Yes, the shirt and jacket each had two holes in the back of the upper chest area. The attempted hijacking or robbery could not have been pre-war. Mail carriers were almost never attacked, even in the late 80s Depression riots, before the golden age of the 90s. Besides, a missing carrier would have been searched for until found. So the attack took place after the 1 week war. But what was a mailman doing driving alone through the countryside after the United States had effectively ceased to exist? How long afterward had this happened? The fellow must have driven off from his ambush, seeking obscure roads and trails to get away from his assailants. Maybe he didn't know the severity of his wounds, or simply panicked. But Gordon suspected that there was another reason the letter carrier had chosen to weave in and out of blackberry thickets to hide deep in forest depths. "He was protecting his cargo," Gordon whispered. He measured the chance he'd black out on the road against the possibility of getting to help, and decided to cash the mail rather than try to live. So this was a bona fide post-war postman, a hero of the flickering twilight of civilization. Gordon thought of the old-time ode of the mails, neither sleet nor hail, and wondered at the fact that some had tried this hard to keep the light alive. That explained the official letters and the lack of junk mail. He hadn't realized that even a semblance of normality had remained for so long. Of course, a 17-year-old militia recruit was unlikely to have seen anything normal. Mob rule and general looting in the main disbursement centers had kept armed authority busy and attrited, until the militia finally vanished into the disturbances it had been sent to quell. If men and women elsewhere were behaving more like human beings during those months of horror, Gordon never witnessed it. The brave story of the postman only served to depress Gordon. This tale of struggle against chaos, by mayors and university professors and postmen, had a what-if flavor that was too poignant for him to consider for long. The tailgate opened reluctantly after some prying. Moving mail sacks aside, he found the letter carrier's hat with its tarnished badge, an empty lunchbox, and a valuable pair of sunglasses lying in thick dust atop a wheel well. A small shovel, intended to help free the jeep from road ruts, would now help to bury the driver. Finally, just behind the driver's seat, broken under several heavy sacks, Gordon found a smashed guitar. A large-caliber bullet had snapped its neck. Near it, a large yellowed plastic bag held a pound of desiccated herbs that gave off a strong, musky odor. Gordon's recollection hadn't faded enough to forget the aroma of marijuana. He had envisioned the postman as a middle-aged, balding, conservative type. Gordon now recreated the image, and made the fellow look more like himself, wiry, bearded, with a perpetual, stunned expression that seemed about to say, "Oh, wow!" A neo-hippie, perhaps. A member of a sub-generation that had hardly begun to flower before the war snuffed it out, and everything else optimistic. A neo-hippie dying to protect the establishment's mail. It didn't surprise Gordon in the slightest. He had had friends in the movement, sincere people, if maybe a little strange. Gordon retrieved the guitar strings, and for the first time that morning felt a little guilty. The letter carrier hadn't even been armed. Gordon remembered reading once that the U.S. mail operated across the lines for 3 years into the 1860s Civil War. Perhaps this fellow had trusted his countrymen to respect that tradition. Post-chaos America had no tradition but survival. In his travels, Gordon had found that some isolated communities welcomed him in the same way minstrels had been kindly received far and wide in medieval days. In others, wild varieties of paranoia reigned. Even in those rare cases where he had found friendliness, where decent people seemed willing to welcome a stranger, Gordon had always before long moved on. Always he found himself beginning to dream again of wheels turning and things flying in the sky. It was already mid-morning. His gleanings here were enough to make the chances of survival better without a confrontation with the bandits. The sooner he was over the pass, then, and into a decent watershed, the better off he would be. Right now, nothing would serve him half so well as a stream, somewhere out of the range of the bandit gang where he could fish for trout to fill his belly. One more task here. He hefted the shovel. Hungry or not, you owe the guy this much. He looked around for a shady spot with soft earth to dig in and a view. 4.
They said, "Fear not, Macbeth, till Birnam Wood comes to Dunsinane, and now a wood comes to Dunsinane, Arm, arm, arm yourselves. If this is what the witch spoke of, that thing out there, there'll be no running or hiding here.
Gordon clutched his wooden sword, contrived from planking and a bit of tin. He motioned to an invisible aide-de-camp.
I'm getting weary of the sun, and wish the world were undone. Ring the alarm bell, blow wind, come rack. At least we'll die with harness on our back.
Gordon squared his shoulders, flourished his sword, and marched Macbeth off stage to his doom. Out of the light of the tallow lamps, he swiveled to catch a glimpse of his audience. They had loved his earlier acts, but this bastardized one-man version of Macbeth might have gone over their heads. An instant after he exited, though, enthusiastic applause began, led by Mrs. Adele Thompson, the leader of this small community. Adults whistled and stamped their feet. Younger citizens clapped awkwardly. Those below 20 years of age watching their elders and slapping their hands awkwardly, as if they were taking part in this strange rite for the first time. Obviously, they had liked his abbreviated version of the ancient tragedy. Gordon was relieved. To be honest, some parts had been simplified less for brevity than because of his imperfect memory of the original. He had last seen a copy of the play almost a decade ago, and that a half-burnt fragment. Still, the final lines of his soliloquy had been canon. That part about wind and rack he would never forget. Grinning, Gordon returned to take his bows on stage. A plank-covered garage lift in what had once been the only gas station in the tiny hamlet of Pine View. Hunger and isolation had driven him to try the hospitality of this mountain village of fenced fields and stout log walls, and the gamble had paid off better than he'd hoped. An exchange of a series of shows for his meals and supplies had tentatively passed by a fair majority of the voting adults, and now the deal seemed settled.
"Bravo! Excellent!"
Mrs. Thompson stood in the front row, clapping eagerly. White-haired and bony, but still robust, she turned to encourage the 40-odd others, including small children, to show their appreciation. Gordon did a flourish with one hand and bowed deeper than before. Of course, his performance had been pure crap, but he was probably the only person within 100 miles who had once minored in drama. There were peasants once again in America, and like his predecessors in the minstrel trade, Gordon had learned to go for the unsubtle in his shows. Timing his final bow for the moment before the applause began to fade, Gordon hopped off the stage and began removing his slapdash costume. He had set firm limits. There would be no encore. His stock was theater, and he meant to keep them hungry for it until it was time to leave.
"Marvelous! Just wonderful!"
Mrs. Thompson told him as he joined the villagers, now gathering at a buffet table along the back wall. The older children formed a circle around him, staring in wonderment. Pine View was quite prosperous, compared with so many of the starving villages of the plains and mountains. In some places, a good part of a generation was nearly missing, due to the devastating effects the 3-year winter had had on children. But here he saw several teenagers and young adults, and even a few oldsters who must have been past middle age when the doom fell. They must have fought to save everybody. That pattern had been rarer, but he had seen it, too, here and there. Everywhere there were traces of those years. Faces pocked from diseases or etched from weariness and war. 2 women and a man were amputees, and another looked out of one good eye, the other a cloudy mass of cataracts. He was used to such things, at least on a superficial level. He nodded gratefully to his host. "Thank you, Mrs. Thompson. I appreciate kind words from a perceptive critic. I'm glad you liked the show."
"No, no, seriously," the clan leader insisted, as if Gordon had been trying to be modest. "I haven't been so delighted in years. The Macbeth part at the end there sent shivers up my spine. I only wish I'd watched it on TV back when I had a chance. I didn't know it was so good. And that inspiring speech you gave us earlier, that one of Abraham Lincoln's, well, you know, we tried to start a school here in the beginning, but it just didn't work out. We needed every hand, even the kids. Now, though, well, that speech got me to thinking. We've got some old books put away. Maybe now's the time to give it a try again."
Gordon nodded politely. He had seen this syndrome before.
the best of the dozen or so types of reception he had experienced over the years, but also among the saddest. It always made him feel like a charlatan when his shows brought out grand, submerged hopes in a few of the decent older people who remembered better days, hopes that, to his knowledge, had always fallen through before a few weeks or months had passed. It was as if the seeds of civilization needed more than goodwill and the dreams of aging high school graduates to water them. Gordon often wondered if the right symbol might do the trick, the right idea. But he knew his little dramas, however well received, weren't the key. They might trigger a beginning once in a great while, but local enthusiasm always failed soon after. He was no traveling messiah. The legends he offered weren't the kind of sustenance needed in order to overcome the inertia of a dark age. The world turns, and soon the last of the old generation will be gone. Scattered tribes will rule the continent. Perhaps in 1,000 years the adventure will begin again. Meanwhile, Gordon was spared hearing more of Mrs. Thompson's sadly unlikely plans. The crowd squeezed out a small silver-haired black woman, wiry and leather-skinned, who seized Gordon's arm in a friendly, vice-like grip.
"Now, Adele," she said to the clan matriarch, "Mr. Krantz hasn't had a bite since noontime. I think if we want him to be able to perform tomorrow night, we'd better feed him, right?"
She squeezed his right arm, and obviously thought him undernourished, an impression he was loath to alter with the aroma of food wafting his way. Mrs. Thompson gave the other woman a look of patient indulgence.
"Of course, Patricia," she said. "I'll speak with you more about this later, Mr. Krantz, after Mrs. Howlett has fattened you up a bit."
Her smile and her glittering eyes held a touch of intelligent irony, and Gordon found himself reevaluating Adele Thompson. She certainly was nobody's fool. Mrs. Howlett propelled him through the crowd. Gordon smiled and nodded as hands came out to touch his sleeve. Wide eyes followed his every movement. "Hunger must make me a better actor. I've never had an audience react quite like this before. I wish I knew exactly what it was I did that made them feel this way." One of those watching him from behind the long buffet table was a young woman barely taller than Mrs. Howlett, with deep almond eyes and hair blacker than Gordon remembered ever seeing before. Twice she turned to gently slap the hand of a child who tried to help himself before the honored guest. Each time the girl quickly looked back at Gordon and smiled. Behind her, a tall, burly young man stroked his reddish beard and gave Gordon a strange look, as if his eyes were filled with some desperate resignation. Gordon had only a moment to assimilate the two as Mrs. Howlett pulled him over in front of the pretty brunette.
"Abby," she said, "let's have a little bit of everything on a plate for Mr. Krantz. Then he can make up his mind what he wants seconds of. I baked the blueberry pie, Mr. Krantz."
Dizzily, Gordon made a note to have 2 helpings of the blueberry. It was hard to concentrate on diplomacy, though. He hadn't seen or smelled anything like this in years. The odors distracted him from the disconcerting looks and touching hands. There was a large, spit-turned stuffed turkey, a huge steaming bowl of boiled potatoes, dollied up with beer-soaked jerky, carrots, and onions was the second course. Down the table, Gordon saw apple cobbler and an opened barrel of dried apple flakes. "I must cousin a supply of those before I leave." Skipping further inventory, he eagerly held out his plate. Abby kept watching him as she took it. The big, frowning redhead suddenly muttered something indecipherable and reached out to grab Gordon's right hand in both of his own. Gordon flinched, but the taciturn fellow would not let go until he answered the grip and shook hands firmly. The man muttered something too low to follow, nodded, and let go. He bent to kiss the brunette quickly, and then stalked off, eyes downcast. Gordon blinked. Did I just miss something? It felt as if some sort of event had just occurred and had gone completely over his head.
"That was Michael, Abby's husband," Mrs. Howlett said. "He's got to go and relieve Edward at the trap string, but he wanted to stay to see your show first. When he was little, he so used to love to watch TV shows."
Steam from the plate rose to his face, making Gordon quite dizzy with hunger. Abby blushed and smiled when he thanked her. Mrs. Howlett pulled him over to take a seat on a pile of old tires.
"You'll get to talk to Abby later," the black woman went on. "Now you eat. Enjoy yourself."
Gordon did not need to be encouraged. He dug in while people looked on curiously, and Mrs. Howlett rattled on.
"Good, isn't it? You just sit and eat, and pay us no mind. And when you're all full and you're ready to talk again, I think we'd all like to hear one more time how you got to be a mailman."
Gordon looked up at the eager faces above him. He hurriedly took a swig of beer to chase down the two hot potatoes. "I'm just a traveler," he said around a half-full mouth while lifting a turkey drumstick. "It's not much of a story how I got the bag and clothes." He didn't care whether they stared or touched or talked at him, so long as they let him eat. Mrs. Howlett watched him for a few moments. Then, unable to hold back, she started in again.
"You know, when I was a little girl, we used to give milk and cookies to the mailman. And my father always left a little glass of whiskey on the fence for him the day before New Year's. Dad used to tell us that poem, you know, 'Through sleet, through mud, through war, through blight, through bandits, and through darkest night.'"
Gordon choked on a sudden wayward swallow. He coughed and looked up to see if she was in earnest. A glimmer in his forebrain wanted to dance over the old woman's accidentally magnificent remembrance. It was rich. The glimmer faded quickly, though, as he bit into the delicious roast fowl. He hadn't the will to try to figure out what the old woman was driving at. "Our mailman used to sing to us." The speaker, incongruously, was a dark-haired giant with a silver-streaked beard. His eyes seemed to mist as he remembered. "We could hear him coming on Saturdays when we were home from school, sometimes when he was over a block away. He was black, a lot blacker than Mrs. Howlett or Jim Horton over there. Man, did he have a nice voice. Guess that's how he got the job. He brought me all those mail-order coins I used to collect. Ringed the doorbell so he could hand 'em to me, personal, with his own hand." His voice was hushed with telescoped awe.
"Our mailman just whistled when I was little," said a middle-aged woman with a deeply lined face. She sounded a little disappointed. "But he was real nice. Later, when I was grown up, I came home from work one day and found out the mailman had saved the life of one of my neighbors. Heard him choking and gave him mouth-to-mouth till the ambulance came."
A collective sigh rose from the circle of listeners as if they were hearing the heroic adventures of a single ancient hero. The children listened in wide-eyed silence as the tales grew more and more embroidered. At least the small part of him still paying attention figured they had to be. Some were simply too far-fetched to be believed. Mrs. Howlett touched Gordon's knee.
"Tell us again how you got to be a mailman."
Gordon shrugged a little desperately. "I just found the mailman's things," he emphasized around the food in his mouth. The flavors had overcome him, and he felt almost panicky over the way they all hovered over him. If the adult villagers wanted to romanticize their memories of men they had once considered lower-class civil servants at best, that was all right. Apparently they associated his performance tonight with the little touches of extroversion they had witnessed in their neighborhood letter-carriers when they had been children. That, too, was okay. They could think anything they damn well pleased, so long as they didn't interrupt his eating.
"Ah."
Several of the villagers looked at each other knowingly and nodded, as if Gordon's answer had had some profound significance. Gordon heard his own words repeated to those on the edges of the circle.
"He found the mailman's things, so naturally he became—"
His answer must have appeased them somehow, for the crowd thinned as the villagers moved off to take polite turns at the buffet. It wasn't until much later, on reflection, that he perceived the significance of what had taken place there, under boarded windows and tallow lamps, while he crammed himself near to bursting with good food. 5. We have found that our clinic has an abundant supply of disinfectants and painkillers of several varieties. We hear these are in short supply in Bend and in the relocation centers up north. We're willing to trade some of these, along with a truckload of deionizing resin columns that happen to be abandoned here, for 1,000 doses of tetracycline to guard against the bubonic plague outbreak to the east. Perhaps we'd be willing to settle for an active culture of balamycin-producing yeast instead, if someone could come up and show us how to maintain it. Also, we are in desperate need of... The mayor of Gilchrist must have been a strong-willed man to have persuaded his local emergency committee to offer such a trade. Hoarding, however illogical and uncooperative, was a major contributor to the collapse. It astonished Gordon that there still had been people with this much good sense during the first 2 years of the chaos. He rubbed his eyes. Reading wasn't easy by the light of a pair of homemade candles, but he found it difficult getting to sleep on the soft mattress, and damn if he'd sleep on the floor after so long dreaming of such a bed, in just such a room. He had been a little sick earlier. All that food and home-brewed ale had almost taken him over the line from delirious happiness to utter misery. Somehow he had teetered along the boundary for several hours of blurrily remembered celebration, before at last stumbling into the room they had prepared for him. There had been a toothbrush waiting on his nightstand, and an iron tub filled with hot water, and soap. In the bath his stomach had settled, and a warm, clean glow spread over his skin. Gordon smiled when he saw that his postman's uniform had been cleaned and pressed. It lay on a nearby chair. The rips and tears he had crudely patched were now neatly sewn. He could not fault the people of this tiny hamlet for neglecting his one remaining longing, something he had gone without too long to even think about. Enough. This was almost paradise. As he lay in a sated haze between a pair of elderly but clean sheets, waiting leisurely for sleep to come, he read a piece of correspondence between two long-dead men. The mayor of Gilchrist went on. "We are having extreme difficulty with local gangs of survivalists. Fortunately, these infestations of egotists are mostly too paranoid to band together. They're as much trouble to each other as to us, I suppose. Still, they are becoming a real problem. Our deputy is regularly fired on by well-armed men in army surplus camouflage clothing. No doubt the idiots think he's a Russian lackey or some such nonsense. They have taken to hunting game on a massive scale, killing everything in the forest, and doing a typically rotten job of butchering and preserving the meat. Our own hunters come back disgusted over the waste, often having been shot at without provocation. I know it's a lot to ask, but when you can spare a platoon from relocation riot duty, could you send them up here to help us root out these self-centered, hoarding, romantic scoundrels from their little filtered armories? Maybe a unit or two of the U.S. Army will convince them that we won the war and have to cooperate with each other from now on." He put the letter down. So it had been that way here, too. The cliched last straw had been this plague of survivalists, particularly those following the high priest of violent anarchy, Nathan Holn. One of Gordon's duties in the militia had been to help weed out some of those small gangs of city-bred cutthroats and gun-nuts. The number of fortified caves and cabins his unit had found, in the prairie and on little lake islands, had been staggering. All set up in a rash of paranoia in the difficult decades before the war. The irony of it was that we had things turned around. The Depression was over. People were at work again and cooperating. Except for a few crazies, it looked like a renaissance was coming, for America and the world. But we forgot just how much harm a few crazies could do, in America and in the world. Of course, when the collapse did come, the solitary survivalists' precious little fortresses did not stay theirs for long. Most of the tiny bastions changed hands a dozen or more times in the first months. They were such tempting targets. The battles had raged all over the plains until every solar collector was shattered, every windmill wrecked, and every cache of valuable medicines scattered in the never-ending search for heavy dope. Only the ranches and villages, those possessing the right mixture of ruthlessness, internal cohesion, and common sense, survived in the end. By the time the guard units had all died at their posts, or themselves dissolved into roving gangs of battling survivalists, very few of the original population of armed and armored hermits remained alive. Gordon looked at the letter's postmark again. Nearly 2 years after the war. He shook his head. I never knew anyone held on so long. The thought hurt, like a dull wound inside him. Anything that made the last 16 years seem avoidable was just too hard to imagine. There was a faint sound. Gordon looked up, wondering if he had imagined it. Then, only slightly louder, another faint knock rapped at the door to his room. "Come in," he called. The door opened about halfway. Abby, the petite girl with a vaguely oriental cast to her eyes, smiled timidly from the opening. Gordon refolded the letter and slipped it into its envelope. He smiled. "Hello, Abby. What's up?"
I've come to ask if there is anything else you needed," she said a little quickly. "Did you enjoy your bath?"
"Did I know?" Gordon sighed. He found himself slipping back into Macduff's burr. "Aye, lass. And in particular, I appreciated the gift of that toothbrush. Heaven sent it was."
"You mentioned you'd lost yours."
She looked at the floor.
"I pointed out that we had at least 5 or 6 unused ones in the storage room. I'm glad you were pleased."
"It was your idea," he bowed. "Then I am indeed in your debt." Abby looked up and smiled.
"Was that a letter you were just reading? Could I look at it? I've never seen a letter before."
Gordon laughed. "Oh, surely you're not that young. What about before the war?" Abby blushed at his laughter.
"I was only 4 when it happened. It was so frightening and confusing that I really don't remember much from before."
Gordon blinked. Had it really been that long? Yes. 16 years was indeed enough time to have beautiful women in the world who knew nothing but the Dark Age. Amazing, he thought. All right, then. He pushed the chair by his bed. Grinning, she came over and sat beside him. Gordon reached into the sack and pulled out another of the frail, yellowed envelopes. Carefully, he spread out the letter and handed it to her. Abby looked at it so intently that he thought she was reading the whole thing. She concentrated, her thin eyebrows almost coming together in a crease on her forehead. But finally she handed the letter back.
"I guess I can't really read that well. I mean, I can read labels on cans and stuff, but I never had much practice with handwriting and sentences."
Her voice dropped at the end. She sounded embarrassed, but in a totally unafraid, trusting fashion, as if he were her confessor. He smiled. "No matter. I'll tell you what it's about." He held the letter up to the candlelight. Abby moved over to sit by his knees on the edge of the bed, her eyes rapt on the pages. "It's from one John Briggs of Fort Rock, Oregon, to his former employer in Klamath Falls. I'd guess from the lathe and hobby horse letterhead that Briggs was a retired machinist or carpenter or something." "Hmm." Gordon concentrated on the barely legible handwriting. "It seems Mr. Briggs was a pretty nice man. Here he's offering to take in his ex-boss's children until the emergency is over. Also, he says he has a good garage machine shop, his own power, and plenty of metal stock. He wants to know if the man wants to order any parts made up, especially things in short supply." Gordon's voice faltered. He was still so thick-headed from his excesses that it had just struck him that a beautiful female was sitting on his bed. The depression she made in the mattress tilted his body toward her. He cleared his throat quickly and went back to scanning the letter. "Briggs mentions something about power levels from the Fort Rock Reservoir. Telephones were out, but he was still, oddly enough, getting Eugene on his computer data net." Abby looked at him. Apparently much of what he had said about the letter writer might as well have been in a foreign language to her. Machine shop and data net could have been ancient magical words of power.
"Why didn't you bring us any letters here in Pine View?" she asked quite suddenly.
Gordon blinked at the non sequitur. The girl wasn't stupid. One could tell such things. Then why had everything he said, when he arrived here and later at the party, been completely misunderstood? She still thought he was a mailman, as apparently did all but a few of the others in this small settlement. From whom did she imagine they'd get mail? She probably didn't realize that the letters he carried had been sent long ago from dead men and women to other dead men and women, or that he carried them for his own reasons. The myth that had spontaneously developed here in Pine View depressed Gordon. It was one more sign of the deterioration of civilized minds, many of whom had once been high school and even college graduates. He considered telling her the truth, as brutally and frankly as he could, to stop this fantasy once and for all. He started to. "There aren't any letters, because..." He paused. Again Gordon was aware of her nearness, the scent of her and the gentle curves of her body. Of her trust as well. He sighed and looked away. "There aren't any letters for you folks, because I'm coming west out of Idaho, and nobody back there knows you here in Pineview. From here I'm going to the coast. There might even be some large towns left. Maybe
someone down there will write to us, if we send them a letter first."
Abby's eyes were bright.
"Then, when you pass this way again, on your way back to Idaho, you could give us the letters they send, and maybe do another play act for us like tonight. And we'll have so much beer and pie for you, you'll bust."
She hopped a little on the edge of the bed.
"By then I'll be able to read better, I promise."
Gordon shook his head and smiled. It was beyond his right to dash such dreams. "Maybe so, Abby. Maybe so. But, you know, you may get to learn to read easier than that. Mrs. Thompson's offered to put it up for a vote to let me stay on here for a while. I guess officially I'd be schoolteacher, though I'd have to prove myself as good a hunter and farmer as anybody. I could give archery lessons." He stopped. Abby's expression was open-mouthed in surprise. She shook her head vigorously.
"But you haven't heard. They voted on it after you went to take your bath. Mrs. Thompson should be ashamed of trying to bribe a man like you that way, with your important work having to be done."
He sat forward, not believing his ears.
"What did you say?"
He had formed hopes of staying in Pineview for at least the cold season, maybe a year or more. Who could tell? Perhaps the wanderlust would leave him, and he could finally find a home. His sated stupor dissipated. Gordon fought to hold back his anger. To have the chance revoked on the basis of the crowd's childish fantasies? Abby noticed his agitation and hurried on.
"That wasn't the only reason, of course. There was the problem of there being no woman for you. And then..."
Her voice lowered perceptibly.
"And then Mrs. Howlett thought you'd be perfect for helping me and Michael finally have a baby."
Gordon blinked. He said, expressing the sudden and complete contents of his mind.
"We've been trying for 5 years," she explained. "We really want children, but Mr. Horton thinks Michael can't because he had the mumps really bad when he was 12. You remember the real bad mumps, don't you?"
Gordon nodded, recalling friends who had died. The resultant sterility had made for unusual social arrangements everywhere he had traveled. "Still," Abby went on quickly,
"well, it would cause problems if I asked any of the other men here to be the body father. I mean, when you live close to people like this, you have to look on the men who aren't your husband as not being really men. At least not that way. I don't think I'd like it, and it might cause trouble."
She blushed.
"Besides, I'll tell you something if you promise to keep a secret. I don't think any of the other men would be able to give Michael the kind of son he deserves. He's really very smart, you know. He's the only one of us youngers who can really read."
The flow of strange logic was coming on too fast for Gordon to follow completely. Part of him dispassionately noted that this was all really an intricate and subtle tribal adaptation to a difficult social problem. That part of him, though, the last 20th-century intellectual, was still a bit drunk, and meanwhile the rest was starting to realize what Abby was driving at.
"You're different."
She smiled at him.
"I mean, even Michael saw that right from the start. He's not too happy, but he figures you'll only be through once a year or so, and he could stand that. He'd rather that than never have any kids."
Gordon cleared his throat. "You're sure he feels this way?"
"Oh, yes. Why do you think Mrs. Howlett introduced us in that funny way?" "It was to make it clear without really saying it out loud. Mrs. Thompson doesn't like it much, but I think that's because she wanted you to stay."
Gordon's mouth felt dry. "How do you feel about all this?" Her expression was enough of an answer. She looked at him as if he were some sort of visiting prophet, or at least a hero out of a storybook.
"I'd be honored if you'd say yes," she said quietly,
and lowered her eyes. "And you'd be able to think of me as a man that way?" Abby grinned. She answered by crawling on top of him and planting her mouth intensely upon his. There was a momentary pause as she shimmied out of her clothes, and Gordon turned to snuff out the candles on the bedstand. Beside them lay the letterman's gray uniform cap, its brass badge casting multiple reflections of the dancing flames. The figure of a rider hunched forward on horseback before bulging saddlebags seemed to move at a flickering gallop. "This is another one I owe you, Mr. Postman." Abby's smooth skin slid along his side. Her hand slipped into his as he took a deep breath and blew the candles out. 6. For 10 days, Gordon's life followed a new pattern. As if to catch up on 6 months' road weariness, he slept late each morning and awoke to find Abby gone, like the night's dreams. Yet her warmth and scent lingered on the sheets when he stretched and opened his eyes. The sunshine streaming through his eastward-facing window was like something new, a springtime in his heart, and not really early autumn at all. He rarely saw her during the day, as he washed and helped with chores until noon, chopping and stacking wood for the community supply, and digging a deep pit for a new outhouse. When most of the village gathered for the main meal of the day, Abby returned from tending the flocks. But she spent lunchtime with the younger children, relieving old one-legged Mrs. Lowes, their work supervisor. The little ones laughed as she kidded them, plucking the wool that coated their clothes from a morning spent carding skeins for the winter spinning, helping them keep the gray strands out of their food. She barely glanced at Gordon, but that brief smile was enough. He knew he had no rights beyond these few days, and yet a shared look in the daylight made him feel that it was all real and not just a dream. Afternoons he conferred with Mrs. Thompson and the other village leaders, helping them inventory books and other long-neglected salvage. At intervals he gave reading and archery lessons. One day he and Mrs. Thompson traded methods in the art of field medicine while treating a man clawed by a tiger, what the locals called the new strain of mountain lion, which had bred with leopards escaped from zoos in the post-war chaos. The trapper had surprised the beast with its kill, but fortunately it had only batted him into the brush and let him run away. Gordon and the village matriarch felt sure the wound would heal. In the evenings, all of Pineview gathered in the big garage, and Gordon recited stories by Twain and Sales and Keeler. He led them in singing old folk songs and lovingly remembered commercial jingles and in playing Remember When. Then it was time for drama. Dressed in scrap and foil, he was John Paul Jones, shouting defiance from the deck of the Bonhomme Richard. He was Anton Perceval, exploring the dangers of a faraway world and the depths of his own potential with a mad robot companion. And he was Dr. Hudson, wading through the horror of the Kenyan conflict to treat the victims of biological war. At first, Gordon always felt uneasy, putting on a flimsy costume and stomping across the makeshift stage, waving his arms, shouting lines only vaguely recalled or made up on the spot. He had never really admired play-acting as a profession, even before the Great War. But it had got him halfway across the continent, and he was good at it. He felt the rapt gaze of the audience, their hunger for wonder and something of the world beyond their narrow valley, and their eagerness warmed him to the task. Pox-scarred and wounded, bent from year after year of back-breaking labor merely to survive, they looked up, the need greatest in eyes clouded with age, a yearning for help doing what they could no longer accomplish alone. Remembering. Wrapped in his rolls, he gave them bits and pieces of lost romance, and by the time the last lines of his soliloquy faded, he too was able to forget the present, at least for a while. Each night after he retired, she came to him. For a while she would sit on the edge of his bed and talk of her life, about the flocks and the village children, and Michael. She brought him books to ask their meanings and questioned him about his youth, about the life of a student in the wonderful days before the Doom War. Then, after a time, Abby would smile, put away the dusty volumes, and slide under the covers next to him while he leaned over and took care of the candle. On the 10th morning, she did not slip away with the pre-dawn light, but instead wakened Gordon with a kiss. Good morning, he commented, and reached for her. But Abby pulled away. She picked up her clothes, brushing her breasts across the soft hairs of his flat stomach.
I should let you sleep, she told him, but I wanted to ask you something.
She held her dress in a ball. What is it? Gordon stuffed the pillow behind his head for support.
You're going to be leaving today, aren't you? She asked.
Yes, he nodded seriously. It's probably best. I'd like to stay longer, but since I can't, I'd better be heading west again.
I know, she nodded seriously. We'll all hate to see you go, but... Well, I'm going to meet Michael out at the trap line this evening. I miss him terribly.
She touched the side of his face.
That doesn't bother you, does it? I mean, it's been wonderful here with you, but he's my husband, and...
He smiled and covered her hand. To his amazement, he had little difficulty with his feelings. He was more envious than jealous of Michael. The desperate logic of their desire for children and their obvious love for one another made the situation, in retrospect, as obvious as the need for a clean break at the end. He only hoped he had done them the favor they sought, for despite their fantasies, it was unlikely he would ever come this way again.
"I have something for you," Abby said.
She reached under the bed and pulled out a small silvery object on a chain and a paper package.
"It's a whistle. Mrs. Howlett says you should have one."
She slipped it over his neck and adjusted it until satisfied with the effect.
"Also, she helped me write this letter."
Abby picked up the little package.
"I found some stamps in a drawer in the gas station, but they wouldn't stick on. So I got some money instead. This is $14. Will it be enough?"
She held out a cluster of faded bills. Gordon couldn't help smiling. Yesterday, 5 or 6 of the others had privately approached him. He had accepted their little envelopes and similar payments for postage with as straight a face as possible. He might have used the opportunity to charge them something he needed, but the community had already given him a month's stock of jerky, dried apples, and 20 straight arrows for his bow. There was no need, nor had he the desire to extort anything else. Some of the older citizens had had relatives in Eugene or Portland, or towns in the Willamette Valley. It was the direction he was heading, so he took the letters. A few were addressed to people who had lived in Oak Ridge and Blue River. Those he filed deep in the safest part of his sack. The rest he might as well throw into Crater Lake for all the good they would ever do, but he pretended anyway. He soberly counted out a few bills, then handed back the rest of the worthless currency. "And who are you writing to?" Gordon asked Abby as he took the letter. He felt as if he were playing Santa Claus and found himself enjoying it.
"I'm writing to the university. You know, at Eugene. I asked a bunch of questions, like, are they taking new students yet? And do they take married students?"
Abby blushed.
"I know I'd have to work real hard on my reading to get good enough, and maybe they aren't recovered enough to take many new students. But Michael's already so smart, and by the time we hear from them, maybe things will be better."
"By the time you hear," Gordon shook his head. Abby nodded.
"I'll for sure be reading a lot better by then. Mrs. Thompson promises she'll help me, and her husband has agreed to start a school this winter. I'm going to help with the little kids. I hope maybe I can learn to be a teacher. Do you think that's silly?"
Gordon shook his head. He had thought himself beyond surprise, but this touched him. In spite of Abby's totally disproportionate view of the state of the world, her hope warmed him, and he found himself dreaming along with her. There was no harm in wishing, was there?
"Actually," Abby went on, confidentially, twisting her dress in her hands, "one of the big reasons I'm writing is to get a pen pal. That's the word, isn't it? I'm hoping maybe someone in Eugene will write to me. That way we'll get letters here. I'd love to get a letter. Also,"
her gaze fell,
"that will give you another reason to come back in a year or so, besides maybe wanting to see the baby."
She looked up and dimpled.
"I got the idea from your Sherlock Holmes play. That's an ulterior motive, isn't it?"
She was so delighted with her own cleverness, and so eager for his approval. Gordon felt a great, almost painful rush of tenderness. Tears welled as he reached out and pulled her into an embrace. He held her tightly and rocked slowly, his eyes shut against reality, and he breathed in with her sweet smell a light and optimism he had thought gone from the world. 7.
"Well, this is where I turn back."
Mrs. Thompson shook hands with Gordon.
"Down this road, things should be pretty tame until you get to Davis Lake. The last of the old loner survivalists that way wiped each other out some years back, though I'd still be careful if I were you."
There was a chill in the air, for autumn had arrived in full. Gordon zipped up the old letter carrier's jacket and adjusted the leather bag as the straight-backed old woman handed him an old road map.
"I had Jimmy Horton mark the places we know of, where homesteaders have set up. I wouldn't bother any of them unless you have to. Mostly they're a suspicious type, likely to shoot first. We've only been trading with the nearest for a short time."
Gordon nodded. He folded the map carefully and slipped it into a pouch. He felt rested and ready. He would regret leaving Pineview as much as any haven in recent memory. But now that he was resigned to going, he actually felt a growing eagerness to be traveling, to see what had happened in the rest of Oregon. In the years since he had left the wreckage of Minnesota, he had found ever wilder signs of the Dark Age. But now he was in a new watershed. This had once been a pleasant state with dispersed light industry, productive farms, and an elevated level of culture. Perhaps it was merely Abby's innocence infecting him. But logically, the Willamette Valley would be the place to look for civilization, if it existed anywhere anymore. He took the old woman's hand once again. "Mrs. Thompson, I'm not sure I could ever repay what you people have done for me." She shook her head. Her face was deeply tanned, and so lined Gordon was certain she had to be more than the 50 years she claimed.
"No, Gordon, you paid your keep. I would have liked it if you could have stayed and helped me get the school going. But now I see maybe it won't be so hard to do it by ourselves."
She gazed out over her little valley.
"You know, we've been living in a kind of a daze these last years since the crops have started coming in and the hunting's returned. You can tell how bad things have gotten when a bunch of grown men and women who once had jobs, who read magazines, and filled out their own taxes, for heaven's sake, start treating a poor, battered, wandering play-actor as if he were something like the Easter Bunny."
She looked back at him.
"Even Jim Horton gave you a couple of letters to deliver, didn't he?"
Gordon's face felt hot. For a moment he was too embarrassed to face her. Then all at once he burst out laughing. He wiped his eyes in relief at having the group fantasy lifted from his shoulders. Mrs. Thompson chuckled as well.
"Oh, it was harmless, I think. And more than that. You've served as a, you know, that old automobile thing. A catalyst, I think. You know, the children are already exploring ruins for miles around, between chores and supper, bringing me all the books they find. I won't have any trouble making school into a privilege. Imagine punishing them by suspending them from class. I hope Bobby and I handle it right."
"I wish you the best of luck, Mrs. Thompson," Gordon said sincerely. "God, it would be nice to see a light somewhere in all this desolation."
"Right, son. That'd be bliss."
Mrs. Thompson sighed.
"I'd recommend you wait a year, but come on back. You're kind. You treated my people well. And you're discreet about some things, like that business with Abby and Michael."
She frowned momentarily.
"I think I understand what went on there, and I guess it's for the best. Got to adjust, I suppose. Anyway, like I said, you're always welcome back."
Mrs. Thompson turned to go, walked 2 paces, then paused. She half turned to look back at Gordon. For a moment her face betrayed a hint of confusion and wonder.
"You aren't really a postman, are you?" she asked suddenly.
Gordon smiled. He set the cap with its bright brass emblem on his head. "If I bring back some letters, you'll know for sure." She nodded gruffly, then set off up the ruined asphalt road. Gordon watched her until she passed the first bend. Then he turned about to the west, and the long downgrade toward the Pacific. 8. The barricades had been long abandoned. The battle wall on Highway 58 at the east end of Oak Ridge had weathered into a tumbled tell of concrete debris and curled rusting steel. The town itself was silent. This end, at least, was clearly long abandoned. Gordon looked down the main street, reading its story. 2, possibly 3 pitched battles had been fought here. A storefront with a canted sign, Emergency Services Clinic, sat at the center of a major circle of devastation. 3 intact panes reflected morning sunlight from the top floor of a hotel. Elsewhere, though, even where store windows had been boarded, the prismatic sparkle of shattered glass glistened on the buckled pavement. Not that he had really expected anything better, but some of the feelings he had carried with him out of Pine View had led to hopes for more islands of peace, especially now that he was in the fertile watershed of the Willamette Valley. If no living town, at least Oak Ridge might have shown other signs conducive to optimism. There might have been traces of methodical reclamation, for instance. If an industrial civilization existed here in Oregon, towns such as this one should have been harvested of anything usable. But just 20 yards from his vantage point, Gordon saw the wreckage of a gas station. A big mechanic's tool cabinet lay on its side, its store of wrenches, pliers, and replacement wiring scattered on the oil-stained floor. A row of never-used tires still hung on a rack high above the service lifts. From this, Gordon knew Oak Ridge to be the worst of all possible Oak Ridges, at least from his point of view. The things needed by a machine culture were available at every hand, untouched and rotting, implying there was no such technological society anywhere near. At the same time, he would have to pick through the wreckage of 50 waves of previous looters in his search for anything useful to a single traveler like himself. Well, he sighed, I've done it before. Even sifting through the downtown ruins of Boise, the gleaners before him had missed a small treasure trove of canned food in a loft behind a shoe store. Some hoarder's stash, long untouched. There was a pattern to such things, worked out over the years. He had his own methods for conducting a search. Gordon slipped down on the forest side of the barricade baffle and entered the overgrowth. He zigzagged, on the off chance he had been watched. At a place where he could verify landmarks in 3 different directions, Gordon dropped his leather shoulder bag and cap under an autumn-bright red cedar. He took off the dark brown letter carrier's jacket and laid it on top, then cut brush to cover the cache. He would go to any lengths to avoid conflict with suspicious locals, but only a fool would leave his weapons behind. There were 2 types of fighting that could come out of a situation like this. For one, the silence of the bow might be better. For the other, it could be worth expending precious, irreplaceable 38 cartridges. Gordon checked the pistol's action and reholstered it. His bow he carried, along with arrows and a cloth sack for salvage. In the first few houses on the outskirts, the early looters had been more exuberant than thorough. Often the wreckage in such places discouraged those who came after, leaving useful items within. He had found it true often before. Still, by the 4th house, Gordon had a poor collection to show for this theory. His sack contained a pair of boots almost useless from mildew, a magnifying glass, and 2 spools of thread. He had poked into all the usual and some unconventional hoarder's crannies and found no food of any sort. His Pine View jerky wasn't gone, but he had dipped down farther than he liked. His archery was better, and he had bagged a small turkey 2 days ago. Still, if he didn't have better luck gleaning, he might have to give up on the Willamette Valley for now and get to work on a winter hunting camp. What he really wanted was another haven, such as Pine View. But fate had been kind enough lately. Too much good luck made Gordon suspicious. He moved on to a 5th house. The 4-poster bed stood in what had been a prosperous physician's 2-story home. Like the rest of the house, the bedroom had been stripped of nearly everything but the furniture. Nevertheless, as he crouched down over the heavy area rug, Gordon thought he might have found something the earlier looters had missed. The rug seemed out of place. The bed rested upon it, but only with the right pair of legs. The left pair lay directly on the hardwood floor. Either the owner had been sloppy in placing the big oval carpet, or... Gordon put down his burdens and grabbed the edge of the rug.
Phew, it's heavy.
He started rolling it toward the bed.
Yes.
There was a thin, square crack in the floor under the carpet. A bed leg pinned the rug over one of two brass door hinges, a trap door. He pushed hard on the bedpost. The leg hopped and fell again with a boom. Twice more he shoved, and loud echoes reverberated. On his fourth heave, the bedpost snapped in two. Gordon barely escaped impalement on the jagged stub as he toppled onto the mattress. The canopy followed, and the aged bed collapsed in a crash. Gordon cursed, fighting with a smothering shroud. He sneezed violently in a cloud of floating dust. Finally, regaining a bit of sense, he managed to slither out from under the ancient moldy fabric. He stumbled out of the room, still sputtering and sneezing. The attack subsided slowly. He gripped the upstairs banister, squinting in that torturous, semi-orgasmic state that comes before a whopping sternutation. His ears rang with an extra murmur that seemed almost like voices. "Next thing you'll be hearing church bells," he told himself. The final sneeze came at last, and a loud, Wiping his eyes, he re-entered the bedroom. The trap door lay fully exposed, layered under a new coating of dust. Gordon had to pry the edge of the secret panel. Finally, it lifted with a high, rusty scree. Again, it seemed as though some of the sound came from outside the house. But when he stopped and listened carefully, Gordon heard nothing. Impatiently, he bent down and brushed aside cobwebs to peer into the cache. There was a large metal box inside. He poked around, hoping for more. After all, the things a pre-war doctor might have kept in a locked chest, money and documents, would be of less use to him than canned goods stashed here in a spree of wartime hoarding. But there was nothing other than the box. Gordon hauled it out, puffing. Good, it's heavy. Now let's hope it's not gold or any similar crap. The hinges and lock were rusted. He lifted the haft of his knife to smash the small lock. Then he stopped abruptly. Now they were unmistakable. The voices were close, too close.
"I think it came from this house," someone called from the overgrown garden outside.
Feet shuffled through the dry leaves. There were steps on the wooden porch. Gordon sheathed the knife and snatched up his gear. Leaving the box by the bed, he hurried out of the room to the stairwell. This was not the best of circumstances to meet other men. In Boise and other mountain ruins, there had been almost a code. Gleaners from ranches all around could try their luck in the open city, and although the groups and individuals were wary, they seldom preyed on one another. Only one thing could bring them all together, a rumor that someone had sighted a hole nest somewhere. Otherwise, they pretty much left each other alone. In other places, though, territoriality was the rule, and fiercely enforced. Gordon might be searching in some such clan's turf. A quick departure would in any case be discreet. Still, he looked back at the strongbox anxiously. It's mine, damn it. Boots clomped noisily downstairs. It was too late to close the trapdoor or hide the heavy treasure chest. Gordon cursed silently and hurried as quietly as he could across the upstairs landing to the narrow attic ladder. The top floor was little more than a simple A-frame garret. He had searched among the useless mementos here earlier. Now all he wanted was a hiding place. Gordon kept near the sloping walls to avoid creaks in the floorboards. He chose a trunk near a small gabled window, and there laid his sack and quiver. Quickly he strung his bow. Would they search? In that case, the strongbox would certainly attract attention. If so, would they take it as an offering and leave him a share of whatever it contained? He had known such things to happen, in places where a primitive sort of honor system worked. He had the drop on anyone entering the attic, although it was dubious how much good that would do, cornered in a wooden building. The locals doubtless retained, even in the middle of a dark age, the craft of fire-making. At least three pairs of booted feet could be heard now. In rapid hollow steps they took the stairs, skirmishing up one landing at a time. When everyone was on the second floor, Gordon heard a shout.
"Hey, Carl, look at this!"
"What? You catch a couple of kids playing doctor in an old bed?"
"Shit!"
There was a loud thump, followed by the hammering of metal on metal.
Shit!
Gordon shook his head. Carl had a limited but expressive vocabulary. There were shuffling and tearing sounds, accompanied by more scatological exclamations. At last, though, a third voice spoke up loudly.
"Sure was nice of that fellow finding this for us. Wish we could thank him. Ought to get to know him so we don't shoot first if we ever see him again."
If that was bait, Gordon wasn't taking. He waited.
"Well, at least he deserves a warning," the first voice said even louder. "We gotta shoot first rule in Oak Ridge. He better scat before someone puts a hole in him bigger than the gap between a survivalist's ears."
Gordon nodded, taking the warning at face value. The footsteps receded. They echoed down the stairwell, then out onto the wooden porch. From the gable overlooking the front entrance, Gordon saw three men leave the house and walk toward the surrounding hemlock grove. They carried rifles and bulging canvas day packs. He hurried to the other windows as they disappeared into the woods, but saw no other motion, no signs of anyone doubling back from another side. There had been three pairs of feet. He was sure of it. Three voices. And it wasn't likely only one man would stay in ambush anyway. Still, Gordon was careful as he moved out. He lay down beside the open attic trap door, his bow, bag, and quiver next to him, and crawled until his head and shoulders extended out over the opening, slightly above the level of the floor. He drew his revolver, held it out in front of him, and then let gravity swing his head and torso suddenly downward in a fashion an ambusher would hardly expect. As the blood rushed to his head, Gordon was primed to snap off six quick shots at anything that moved. Nothing did. There was nobody in the second-floor hallway. He reached for his canvas bag, never taking his gaze from the hallway, and dropped it to clatter on the landing. The sound triggered no ambush. Gordon took up his gear and dropped to the next level in a crouch. He quickly moved down a hall, skirmish style. The strong box lay open and empty next to the bed, beside it a scattering of paper trash. As he had expected, there were such curiosities as stock certificates, a stamp collection, and the deed to this house. But some of the other debris was different. A torn cardboard container, the cellophane wrapper newly removed, colorfully depicted a pair of happy canoeists with their new collapsible rifle. Gordon looked at the weapon pictured on the box and stifled a strangled cry. Doubtless there had also been boxes of ammunition. Goddamn thieves, he thought bitterly. But the other trash almost drove him wild. Emperin with codeine, erythromycin, megavitamin complex, morphine. The labels and boxes were strewn about, but the bottles had been taken. Carefully handled, cashed, and traded in dribbles, these could have bought Gordon admission into almost any hamlet. Why, he might even have won a probationary membership in one of the wealthy Wyoming ranch communities. He remembered a good doctor whose clinic in the ruins of Butte was a sanctuary protected by all the surrounding villages and clans. Gordon thought of what that sainted gentleman could have done with these. But his eyesight nearly went dim with dark tunnels of rage when he saw an empty cardboard box whose label read, "Tooth Powder." My tooth powder! Gordon counted to 10. It wasn't enough. He tried controlled breathing. It only helped him focus on his anger. He stood there, slope-shouldered, feeling impotent to answer this one more unkindness by the world. "It's all right," he told himself. "I'm alive. And if I can get back to my backpack, I'll probably stay alive. Next year, if it comes, I can worry about my teeth rotting out of my head." Gordon picked up his gear and resumed his stalking exit out of that house of false expectations. A man who spends a long time alone in the wilderness can have one great advantage over even a very good hunter, if that hunter nevertheless goes home to friends and companions most nights. The difference is a trait in kinship with the animals, with the wilds themselves. It was something as undefinable as that which made him nervous. Gordon sensed that something was odd long before he could attribute it. The feeling would not go away. He had been retracing his steps toward the eastern edge of town, where his gear was cached. Now, though, he stopped and considered. Was he overreacting? He was no Jeremiah Johnson to read the sounds and smells of the woods like street signs in a city. Still, he looked around for something to back up his unease. The forest was mostly western hemlock and big-leaf maple, with alder saplings growing like weeds in nearly every former open area. It was a far cry from the dry woodlands he had passed through on the east side of the Cascades, where he had been robbed under the sparse ponderosa pines. Here there was a scent of life richer than anything he remembered since before the three-year winter. Animal sounds had been scant until he stopped moving. But as he kept still, a flow of avian chatter and movement soon began to flow back into this patch of forest. Gray-feathered camp robbers flitted in small groups from spot to spot, playing guerrilla war with lesser jays for the best of the tiny, bug-rich glades. Smaller birds hopped from branch to branch, chirping and foraging. Birds in this size range had no great love for man, but neither did they go to great lengths to avoid him if he was quiet. Then why am I nervous as a cat? There was a brief snapping sound to his left, near one of the ubiquitous blackberry thickets, about 20 yards away. Gordon whirled, but there, too, there were birds. Correction. A bird. A mockingbird. The creature swooped up through the branches and landed in a bundle of twigs Gordon guessed to be its nest. It stood there like a small lordling, haughty and proud. Then it squawked and dove toward the thicket again. As it passed out of sight, there was another tiny rustle. Then the mockingbird swooped into view again. Gordon idly picked at the loam with his bow while loosening the loop on his revolver, trying hard to maintain a frozen expression of nonchalance. He whistled through fear-dry lips as he walked slowly, moving neither toward the thicket nor away from it, but in the direction of a large grand fir. Something behind that thicket had set off the mockingbird's nest defense response, and that something was trying hard to ignore the nuisance attacks, to stay silently hidden. Alerted, Gordon recognized a hunting blind. He sauntered with exaggerated carelessness, but as soon as he passed behind the fir, he drew his revolver and ran into the forest at a sharp angle, crouching, trying to keep the bulk of the tree between himself and the blackberry bramble. He remained in the tree's umbra only a moment. Surprise protected him a moment longer. Then the cracking of three loud shots, all of different caliber, diffracted down the lattice of trees. Gordon sprinted to a fallen log at the top of a small rise. Three more bangs pealed out as he dove over the decaying trunk and hit the ground on the other side to a sharp snapping sound and stabbing pain in his right arm. He felt a moment's blind panic as the hand holding his revolver cramped. If he had broken his arm! Blood soaked the cuff of his U.S. government-issued tunic. Dread exaggerated the pain until he pulled back his sleeve and saw a long, shallow gash with slivers of wood hanging from the laceration. It was the bow that had broken, stabbing him as he fell on it. Gordon threw the fragments aside and scrambled on hands and knees up a narrow gulch to the right, keeping low to take advantage of the creek bed and underbrush. Behind him, whoops of gleeful chase carried over the tiny hillock. The following minutes were a blur of whipping branches and sudden zigzags. When he splashed into a narrow rivulet, Gordon whirled, then hurried against the flow. Hunted men often will run downstream, he remembered, racing upslope, hoping his enemies knew that bit of trivia. He hopped from stone to stone, trying not to dislodge mud into the water. Then he jumped off into the forest again. There were shouts behind him. Gordon's own footfalls seemed loud enough to wake sleeping bears. Twice he caught his breath behind boulders or clumps of foliage, thinking as well as practicing silence. Finally, the shouts diminished with distance. Gordon sighed as he settled back against a large oak and pulled out his belt pouch aid kit. The wound would be all right. There was no reason to expect infection from the polished wood of the bow. It hurt like hell, but the tear was far from vessels or tendons. He bound it in boiled cloth and simply ignored the pain as he got up and looked around. To his surprise, he recognized two landmarks at once. The towering, shattered sign of the Oak Ridge Motel, seen over the treetops, and a cattle grate across a worn asphalt path just to the east. Gordon moved quickly to the place where he had cached his goods. They were exactly as he had left them. Apparently the fates were not so unsubtle as to deal him another blow just yet. He knew they didn't operate that way. They always let you hope for a while longer, then strung it out before they really let you have it. Now the stalked turned stalker. Cautiously, Gordon sought out the blackberry blind, with its irate resident mockingbird. As expected, it was empty now. He crept around behind to get the ambusher's point of view, and sat there for a few minutes as the afternoon waned, looking and thinking. They had had the drop on him, that was for certain. From this point of view, it was hard to see how they had missed when the three men fired on him. Were they so surprised by his sudden break for it? They must have had semi-automatic weapons, yet he only remembered 6 shots. Either they were being very stingy with ammo, or... He approached the grand fir across the clearing. 2 fresh scars blemished the bark 10 feet up. 10 feet! They couldn't be such bad marksmen. So, it all fit. They had never meant to kill him at all. They had aimed high on purpose to give him a scare and drive him off. No wonder his pursuers never really came close to catching him during his escape into the forest. Gordon's lip curled. Ironically, this made his assailants easier to hate. Unthinking malice he had come to accept, as one must accept foul weather and savage beasts. So many former Americans had become little better than barbarians. But calculated contempt like this was something he had to take personally. These men had the concept of mercy. Still, they had robbed, injured, and terrorized him. He remembered Roger Septine taunting him from that bone-dry hillside. These bastards were no better at all. Gordon picked up their trail 100 yards to the west of the blind. The boot prints were clear and uncovered, almost arrogant in their openness. He took his time, but he never even considered turning back. It was approaching dusk before the palisade that surrounded New Oak Ridge was in sight. An open area that had once been a city park was enclosed by a high wooden fence. From within could be heard the lowing of cattle. A horse whinnied. Gordon smelled hay and the rich odors of livestock. Nearby, a still higher palisade surrounded 3 blocks of what had once been the southwest corner of Oak Ridge Town. A row of 2-story buildings, half a block long, took up the center of the village. Gordon could see the tops of these over the wall, and a water tower with a crow's nest atop it. A silhouetted figure stood watch, looking out over the dimming forest. It looked like a prosperous community, perhaps the best off he had encountered since leaving Idaho. Trees had been cut to make a free-fire zone around the village wall, but that was some time ago. Undergrowth half as high as a man had encroached on the cleared field. Well, there can't be many survivalists in the area anymore, Gordon thought, or they'd be a whole lot less careless. Let's see what the main entrance is like. He skirted around the open area toward the south side of the village. On hearing voices, he drew up cautiously behind a curtain of undergrowth. A large wooden gate swung open. 2 armed men sauntered out, looked around, then waved to someone within. With a shout and a snap of reins, a wagon pulled by 2 draft horses sallied through, then stopped. The driver turned to speak to the 2 guards.
"Tell the mayor I appreciate the loan, Jeff. I know my stead is in the hole pretty deep, but we'll pay him back out of next year's harvest for sure. He already owns a piece of the farm, so it ought to be a good investment for him."
One of the guards nodded.
"Sure thing, sonny. Now you be careful on your way out, okay? Some of the boys spotted a loner down at the east end of Old Town today. There was some shooting." The farmer's breath caught audibly. "Was anyone hurt? Are you sure it was just a loner?"
"Yeah, pretty sure. He ran like a rabbit, according to Bob."
Gordon's pulse pounded faster. The insults had reached a point almost beyond bearing. He put his left hand inside his shirt and felt the whistle Abby had given him hanging from its chain around his neck. He took some comfort from it, remembering decency.
"The feller did the mayor a real favor, though," the first guard went on. "Found a hidey hole full of drugs before Bob's guys drove him off. The mayor's going to pass some of them around to some of the owners at a party tonight to find out what they'll do. I sure wish I moved in those circles."
"Me too," the younger watchman agreed.
"Hey, sonny, you think the mayor might pay you some of your bonus in drugs if you make quota this year? You could have a real party."
Sonny smiled sheepishly and shrugged. Then for some reason his head drooped. The older guard looked at him quizzically.
What's the matter? He asked.
Sonny shook his head. Gordon could barely hear him when he spoke.
We don't wish for very much any more, do we, Gary?
Gary frowned.
What do you mean?
I mean, as long as we're wishing to be like the mayor's cronies, why don't we wish we had a mayor without cronies at all?
Sally and I had 3 girls and 2 boys before the doom, Gary.
I remember, Sonny, but Hal and Peter died in the war. But I counted me and Sally blessed that all 3 girls grew up.
Blessed?
Sonny, it's not your fault. It was just bad luck.
Bad luck? The farmer snorted. One raped to death when those Reavers came through. Peggy dead in childbirth. And my little Susan? She's got gray hair, Gary. She looks like Sally's sister.
There was a long stretch of silence. The older guard put his hand on the farmer's arm.
I'll bring a jug around tomorrow, Sonny, I promise. We'll talk about old days, like we used to.
The farmer nodded without looking up.
He shouted, "Yeah!" and snapped the reins.
For a long moment the guard looked after the creaking wagon, chewing on a grass stem. Finally he turned to his younger companion.
"Jimmy, did I ever tell you about Portland? Sonny and I used to go there before the war. They had this mayor, back when I was a kid, who used to pose for—"
They passed through the gate, out of Gordon's hearing. Under other circumstances, Gordon might have pondered hours over what that one small conversation had revealed about the social structure of Oak Ridge and its environs. The farmer's crop indebtedness, for instance. It was a classic early stage of share-kind serfdom. He had read about things like this in sophomore history tutorial, long ago and in another world. They were features of feudalism. But right now, Gordon had no time for philosophy or sociology. His emotions churned. Outrage over what had happened today was nothing next to his anger over the proposed use of the drugs he had found. When he thought of what the doctor in Wyoming could do with such medicines, why, most of the substances wouldn't even make these ignorant savages high. Gordon was fed up. His bandaged right arm throbbed. I'll bet I could scale those walls without much trouble, find the storage hut and reclaim what I found, along with some extra to make up for the insults, the pain, my broken bow. The image wasn't satisfying enough. Gordon embellished. He envisioned dropping in on the mayor's party and wasting all the power-hungry bastards who were making a midget empire out of this corner of the Dark Age. He imagined acquiring power. Power to do good. Power to force these yokels to use the education of their younger days before the learned generation disappeared forever from the world. Why? Why is nobody anywhere taking responsibility for putting things right again? I'd help. I'd dedicate my life to such a leader. But the big dreams all seemed to be gone. All the good men, like Lieutenant Van and Drew Sims, died defending them. I must be the only one left who still believes in them. Leaving was out of the question, of course. A combination of pride, obstinacy, and simple gonadal fury rooted him in his tracks. Here he would do battle, and that was that. Maybe there's an idealist's militia in heaven or in hell. I guess I'll find out soon. Fortunately, the war hormones left a little space for his forebrain to choose tactics. As the afternoon faded, he thought about what he was going to do. Gordon stepped back into the shadows, and a branch brushed by, dislodging his cap. He caught it before it fell to the ground, was about to put it back on, but then stopped abruptly and looked at it. The burnished image of a horseman glinted back at him, a brass figure backed by a ribbon motto in Latin. Gordon watched shifting highlights in the shiny emblem, and slowly he smiled. It would be audacious, perhaps much more so than attempting the fence in the darkness. But the idea had a pleasing symmetry that appealed to Gordon. He was probably the last man alive who would choose a path of greater danger purely for aesthetic reasons, and he was glad. If the scheme failed, it would still be spectacular. It required a brief foray into the ruins of Old Oak Ridge, beyond the post-war village, to a structure certain to be among the least looted in town. He set the cap back on his head as he moved to take advantage of the remaining light. An hour later, Gordon left the gutted buildings of the old town and stepped briskly along the pitted asphalt road, retracing his steps in the gathering dusk. Taking a long detour through the forest, he came at last to the road Sonny had used, south of the village wall. Now he approached boldly, guided by a solitary lantern hanging over the broad gate. The guard was criminally lax. Gordon came within 30 feet unchallenged. He saw a shadowy sentry standing on a parapet over near the far end of the palisade, but the idiot was looking the other way. Gordon took a deep breath, put Abby's whistle to his lips, and blew 3 hard blasts. The shrill screams pealed through the buildings and forest like the shriek of a stooping raptor. Hurried footsteps pounded along the parapet. 3 men carrying shotguns and oil lanterns appeared above the gate and stared down at him in the gathering twilight. "Who are you? What do you want?" "I must speak with someone in authority," Gordon hailed. "This is official business, and I demand entry to the town of Oak Ridge." That certainly put them off their routine. There was a long, stunned silence as the guards blinked, first at him and then at each other. Finally, one man hurried off while the first speaker cleared his throat. "Come again? Are you feverish? Have you got the sickness?" Gordon shook his head. "I am not ill. I am tired and hungry, and angry over being shot at. But settling all that can wait until I have discharged my duty here." This time the chief guard's voice cracked in blank perplexity. "Discharged? What the hell are you talking about, man?" Hurried footsteps echoed on the parapet. Several more men arrived, followed by a number of children and women who began to string out to the left and right. Discipline apparently wasn't well practiced in Oak Ridge. The local tyrant and his cronies had had things their way for a long time. Gordon repeated himself, slowly and firmly, giving it his best Polonius voice. "I demand to speak with your superiors. You are trying my patience, keeping me out here, and it will definitely go into my report. Now get somebody here with authority to open this gate." The crowd thickened until an unbroken forest of silhouettes topped the palisade. They stared down at Gordon as a group of figures appeared on the parapet to the right, carrying lanterns. The onlookers on that side made way for the newcomers. "Look, loner," the chief guard said, "you're just asking for a bullet. We got no official business with anyone outside this valley. Haven't since we broke relations with that commie place down at Blakeville years ago. You can bet your ass I'm not bothering the mayor for some crazy—" The man turned in surprise as the party of dignitaries reached the gate. "Mr. Mayor, I'm sorry about the ruckus, but I was nearby anyway. Heard the commotion. What's going on here?" The guard gestured. "We got a fella out there babbling like nothing I've heard since the crazy times. He must be sick, or one of those loonies that always used to come through. I'll take care of this." In the growing darkness, the new figure leaned over the parapet. "I'm the mayor of Oak Ridge," he announced. "We don't believe in charity here. But if you're that fellow who found the goodies this afternoon and graciously donated them to my boys, I'll admit we owe you. I'll have a nice hot meal lowered over the gate, and a blanket. You can sleep there by the road. Tomorrow, though, you got to be gone. We don't want no diseases here. And from what my guards tell me, you must be delirious." Gordon smiled. "Your generosity impresses me, Mr. Mayor. But I have come too far on official business to turn away now. First off, can you tell me if Oak Ridge has a working wireless or fiber-optic facility?" The silence brought on by his non sequitur was long and heavy. Gordon could imagine the mayor's puzzlement. At last the boss man answered, "We haven't had a radio in 10 years. Nothing's worked since then. Why? What has that to do with any—" "That's a shame. The airwaves have been a shambles since the war, of course," he improvised. "All the radioactivity, you know. But I'd hoped I could try to use your transmitter to report back to my superiors." He delivered lines with aplomb. This time they brought not silence, but a surge of amazed whispers up and down the parapet. Gordon guessed that most of the population of Oak Ridge must be up there by now. He hoped the wall was well built, It was not in his plan to enter the town like Joshua. He had quite another legend in mind.
"Get a lantern over here," the mayor commanded. "Not that one, you idiot. The one with the reflector." "Yes. Now shine it on that man. I want to look at him."
A bulky lamp was brought forth, and there was a rattle as light speared out at Gordon. He was expecting it, though, and neither covered his eyes nor squinted. He shifted the leather bag and turned to bring his costume to the best angle. The letter carrier's cap, with its polished crest, sat at a rakish angle on his head. The muttering of the crowd grew louder.
"Mr. Mayor," he called, "my patience is limited. I already will have to have words with you about the behavior of your boys this afternoon. Don't force me to exercise my authority in ways both of us would find unpleasant. You're on the verge of losing your privilege of communication with the rest of the nation."
The mayor shifted his weight back and forth rapidly. "Communication? Nation? What is this blither?
It's just the Blakeville Commune, those self-righteous twits down at Culp Creek, and Satan knows what savages beyond them. Who the hell are you, anyway?"
Gordon touched his cap.
"Gordon Krantz of the United States Postal Service. I'm the courier assigned to reestablish a mail route in Idaho and Lower Oregon, and general federal inspector for the region."
And to imagine he had been embarrassed playing Santa Claus back in Pineview. Gordon hadn't thought of the last part about being a federal inspector until it was out of his mouth. Was it inspiration or a dare? Well, might as well be hanged for a sheep as a goat, he thought. The crowd was in tumult. Several times Gordon heard the words outside and inspector, and especially mailman. When the mayor shouted for silence, it came slowly, trailing off into a rapt hush.
"So you're a mailman," the sneer was sarcastic. "What kind of idiots do you take us for, Krantz? A shiny suit makes you a government official? What government? What proof can you give us? Show us you're not a wild lunatic raving with radiation fever."
Gordon pulled out the papers he had prepared only an hour before, using the seal stamp he had found in the ruins of the Oak Ridge post office.
"I have credentials here," but he was interrupted at once. "Keep your papers to yourself, Looney. We're not letting you come close enough to infect us with your fever."
The mayor straightened and waved an arm in the air, addressing his subjects.
"You all remember how crazies and imposters used to come around during the chaos years, claiming to be everything from the Antichrist to Porky Pig? Well, there's one fact we can all depend on. Crazies come and crazies go, but there's only one government, and that's what we got right here."
He turned back to Gordon.
"You're lucky this isn't like the plague years, Looney. Back then, a case like yours would have called for immediate cure by cremation."
Gordon cursed silently. The local tyrant was slick and certainly no easy bluff. If they wouldn't even look at the credentials he had forged, the trip into Old Town this afternoon had been wasted. Gordon was down to his last days. He smiled for the crowd, but he really wanted to cross his fingers. From a side pocket of the leather bag, he pulled out a small bundle. Gordon made a pretense of shuffling through the packet, squinting at labels he knew by heart.
"Is there a Donald Smith here?"
he called up at the townspeople. Heads turned left and right in sudden hushed conversation. Their confusion was obvious even in the gathering darkness. Finally, someone called out,
"He died a year after the war, in the last battle of the warehouses."
There was a tremor in the speaker's voice. Good. Surprise was not the only emotion at work here. Still, he needed something a lot better than that. The mayor was still staring at him, as perplexed as the others, but when he figured out what Gordon was trying to do, there would be trouble.
"Oh, well," Gordon called. "I'll have to confirm that, of course."
Before anyone could speak, he hurried on, shuffling the packet in his hand.
"Is there a Mr. or Mrs. Franklin Thompson in town? Or their son or daughter?"
Now the tide of hushed whispering carried almost a superstitious tone. A woman replied,
"Dad, the boy lived until last year. Worked on the Jesuit stead. His folks were in Portland when it blew."
Damn. Gordon had only one name left. It was all very well to strike their hearts with his knowledge, but what he needed was somebody alive.
"Right," he called. "We'll confirm that.
Finally, is there a Grace Horton here? A Miss Grace Horton?
No, there ain't no Grace Horton, the mayor shouted, confidence and sarcasm back in his voice.
I know everyone in my territory. Never been no Grace Horton in the 10 years since I arrived, you imposter. Can't you all see what he did? He found an old telephone book in town and copied down some names to stir us up with.
He shook a fist at Gordon. Buddy, I rule that you are disturbing the peace and endangering the public health. You've got 5 seconds to be gone before I ordered my men to fire.
Gordon exhaled heavily. Now he had no choice. At least he could beat a retreat and lose nothing more than a little pride.
It was a good try, but you knew the chances of it working were slim. At least you had the bastard going there for a little while.
It was time to go. But to his surprise, Gordon found his body would not turn. His feet refused to move. All will to run away had evaporated. The sensible part of him was horrified as he squared his shoulders and called the mayor's bluff.
Assault on a postal courier is one of the few federal crimes that the pro tem Congress hasn't suspended for the recovery period, Mr. Mayor. The United States has always protected its mailmen.
He looked coldly into the glare of the lamp.
Always, he emphasized.
And for a moment he felt a thrill. He was a courier, at least in spirit. He was an anachronism that the Dark Age had somehow missed when it systematically went about rubbing idealism from the world. Gordon looked straight toward the dark silhouette of the mayor, and silently dared him to kill what was left of their shared sovereignty. For several seconds, the silence gathered. Then the mayor held up his hand.
One.
He counted slowly, perhaps to give Gordon time to run, and maybe for sadistic effect.
Two.
The game was lost. Gordon knew he should leave now at once. Still, his body would not turn.
Three.
This is the way the last idealist dies, he thought. These 16 years of survival had been an accident, an oversight of nature, about to be corrected. In the end, all of his hard-won pragmatism had finally given way to a gesture. There was movement on the parapet. Someone at the far left was struggling forward. The guards raised their shotguns. Gordon thought he saw a few of them move hesitantly, reluctantly. Not that that would do him any good. The mayor stretched out the last count, perhaps a bit unnerved by Gordon's stubbornness. The raised fist began to chop down.
"Mr. Mayor!"
A woman's tremulous voice cut in, her words high-pitched with fear as she reached up to grab the boss man's hand.
"Please, I—"
The mayor shrugged her hands away. "Get away, woman. Get her out of here." The frail shape backed away from the guards, but she cried out clearly.
I'm Grace Horton.
What? The mayor was not alone in turning to stare at her.
It's my maiden name. I was married the year after the second famine. That was before you and your men arrived.
The crowd reacted noisily. The mayor cried out,
Fools! He copied her name from a telephone book, I tell you.
Gordon smiled. He held up the bundle in his hand and touched his cap with the other.
Good evening, Miss Horton. It's a lovely night, yes? By the way, I happen to have a letter here for you from a Mr. Jim Horton of Pineview, Oregon. He gave it to me 12 days ago.
The people on the parapet all seemed to be talking at once. There were sudden motions and excited shouts. Gordon cupped his ear to listen to the woman's amazed exclamation and had to raise his voice to be heard.
Yes, ma'am. He seemed to be quite well. I'm afraid that's all I have on this trip, but I'll be glad to carry your reply to your brother on my way back, after I finish my circuit down in the valley.
He stepped forward closer to the light.
One thing, though, ma'am. Mr. Horton didn't have enough postage back in Pine View, so I'm going to have to ask you for $10. COD.
The crowd roared. Next to the glaring lantern, the figure of the mayor turned left and right, waving his arms and shouting. But nothing he said was heard as the gate swung open and people poured out into the night. They surrounded Gordon, a tight press of hot-faced, excited men, women, children. Some limped. Others bore livid scars or rasped in tuberculin heaviness. And yet at that moment,
the pain of living seemed as nothing next to a glow of sudden faith. In the middle of it all, Gordon maintained his composure and walked slowly toward the portal. He smiled and nodded, especially to those who reached out and touched his elbow, or the wide curve of his bulging leather bag. The youngsters looked at him in superstitious awe. On many older faces, tears streamed. Gordon was in the middle of a trembling adrenaline reaction, but he squelched hard on the little glimmering of conscience, a touch of shame at this lie. The hell with it. It's not my fault they want to believe in the Tooth Fairy. I've finally grown up. I only want what belongs to me. Simpletons. Nevertheless, he smiled all around as the hands reached out, and the love surged forth. It flowed about him like a rushing stream, and carried him in a wave of desperate, unwanted hope into the town of Oak Ridge.